Everybody, it is Monday, May 21st, and I'm calling to order the Senate Interim Committee on Healthcare, Human Services, and Rural Health Policy. And I just want to note just a slight change in the schedule. At 3 p.m., we're going to have the update on the CCO development and implementation. We're going to have the dental care organizations go first, family care go second, Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative go third. That's just a change on that. With that, I would like to call Rocky King and Amy Favé up on an update on the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange, and with me is Amy Favé, who is the soon-to-be officially appointed, has been deputy and soon-to-be officially appointed head of the communication and marketing portion of the exchange also. I guess I probably shouldn't have said that because we really haven't announced that to anybody, have we?
Now you have.
No.
Now you have.
We're happy to be here today. I know we only have about 15 minutes, so we're going to take 5 or 10 minutes to kind of give you a brief overview, and then that'll leave some times for some questions for you. And the first thing I want to make sure is each of you have what we kind of call the, you know, the 100,000 or 30,000 foot kind of overview of a timeline of where we are in the exchange. I want to really kind of point out that it speaks to five major areas that really, I think, touch our stakeholders and our customers the most. Behind this are much more detailed project planning documents and timelines and task sheets that we're working on not only with the exchange but with our partners, the Oregon Health Authority, DCBS, and LFO, for example, and some of our consultants around the IT and communications area. So the first one, though, is really kind of the basic one, and everything is really tied to, and that is called the major milestones. And if you look at that, there are really four or five key areas. The first is the May federal readiness review that we just completed, and we got outstanding, I think, stellar feedback from the feds on that review. They could not believe how much progress we had made, I think, from November until the review this time. We're on time based on the schedule that we had provided them and on task. And I think the other thing that we keep hearing, which is makes us feel good but also scares us, is how much farther ahead we are than most states throughout the country. There are about 30 that really have started working on the exchange, and we're probably in the top two or three in terms of where we are in terms of the exchange development.
Senator Cruz? Rocky, that was going to be one of my questions. I know other states are doing it, but there was just a handful of beta sites, correct? How do you compare? Are you ahead of the other beta sites as well?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I think Maryland was a beta site also. I'll turn to Amy and have us help which states. I know a couple of the beta sites pulled out.
No, there were five.
Right, right.
There were originally seven.
There were five.
There were five, and
two pulled out.
Two of those pulled out.
Right.
I want to say Oklahoma and North Carolina. But we're on par with those other beta states. No question on that.
Madam Chair, part of the reason for that is the beta sites are or the technology that's going to be available to everybody else, and I'm assuming the other beta site technology will be available to us as well. So,
yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, but I want to say it's more than the IT. And the example of that is the conceptual thinking that we've done around the shop exchange for small businesses from a policy perspective, how it's going to be framed, not just the IT piece that they see us as really ahead of other states. So it's not just, you know, building the Oracle system. It's really beginning the really discussion around what it's going to look like, what's going to be the user experience. I mean, those are some of those things that build into that IT piece. The next major milestone that we have coming up is really August or sometime sometime shortly thereafter, we will be putting in our next grant. It's called the Level 2 Grant. And that really takes us through the remainder of the build and our first year of operation. That's through 2014. So remember that the federal government will pay through grants, not only for the build, but the entire operational cost during that first year. That allows you, based on what enrollments you have that first year, to really begin building up some operating reserve prior to January 1, 2014, when you have to be self-sustaining. The next major milestone is in November, fourth quarter of this year, when, as you probably have heard or may have read, the federal government has just come out with what they call the blueprint, the exchange blueprint for states, which really is the pathway to certification in January of 2013. And we must make that application to the federal government in November of this year that basically says, here's what we've done, here are meeting all the requirements that you've laid out, and hopefully January of 2013, then they certify your readiness to move forward. Doesn't mean you've got it all done, but you're on track. You've got the major hurdles. There's always going to be bumps. I'm going to tell you now, there will be risks and bumps all the way through that build time and probably through the first year of operation.
One of the things, Rocky and Amy, that we've been focused on is we're doing Oregon-specific here, not necessarily the template that the feds have. Are they going to allow that sort of flexibility for what we have and not necessarily me crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's in their master plan?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, two things on that. First of all, to give you an idea of the template for Oregon. If you call up the federal government today and say, show us what you have in terms of on your mind for a shop exchange, they send you what we've given them.
Okay.
So some of the federal templates are being developed by the innovator states.
And for the record, my name is Amy Favre with the Health Insurance Exchange. There are certain criteria that are outlined in the federal law in the ACA, so we're building our program around those base requirements, but then where we can make it our own, we are. And so there are some base level requirements that we have to follow in order to receive the certification, but we also have the flexibility both with the feds and in the Senate Bill 99 that you all passed to create our own.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Bates.
I don't want to take you off track. I've only got a few minutes here, but I'm kind of having some anxiety about bringing large systems together here. You're working on one. We have MMIS you have to interface with. You've got Carolyn's programs. And you're going to have to bring these together somehow, some form. The initial bill set you up as a separate corporation. Would you review for me again why we did that? And is there some legal requirement to maintain that? And how you plan to bring these huge systems back together again and actually have them work together?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I believe in... in the discussions when we were putting this together, that the legislature was very interested in flexibility and in being able to make decisions rather quickly as we're going to have to be made over this next year and a half, whether that was from a contracting perspective, a policy decision perspective, while still maintaining the transparency. Which a public corporation has. So I think it really was, I mean, we heard the word all the time, we want you to be nimble and be able to respond quickly. Amy, you want to add to that?
I would, yeah. Senator Bates, members of the committee. When the initial early innovator grant was awarded to Oregon, the public corporation didn't yet exist, so that grant was made to the Oregon Health Authority. And once we were created, the decision was made to leave that grant there. Precisely so, there was that that close connection in the development of these programs. So the Health Authority under Bruce Goldberg's leadership and his CIO, Carolyn Lawson, are overseeing all of the projects, and we're all working very closely together to make sure that those all move forward in their appropriate timeframes.
Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. This is not going to be in the form of a question, really. Probably sometime in the next couple of weeks, I'd like to sit down with you, LFO, the other major components of the system, and have an open conversation about whether or not this can really come together. We don't want another MMIS meltdown, obviously. You admit there's going to be bumps in the road. Appreciate that. Brand new project, a lot of stuff going on. We just can't afford a failure here. So I'd like to have a little closer look at it. We haven't got time today to do it. We have some people in the background behind you are concerned about a $1.9 billion thing going on, and they're kind of interested in that, okay? But I'd like to have that conversation with you, and any members of the committee would like to be there, of course, are welcome. We can't have a quorum. But I'm just got a little bit of concern here. And I'd like to look at it a little more closely, if you don't mind, please.
Madam Chair, I just want to assure you, your concern is no less than my concern in terms of the challenge that we have at this. I'm going to ask Amy to really briefly go through, I think, the four major, other major areas, if you would.
Sounds good. And I'll try to do this fairly quickly so we can have more time for questions. The next line in the roadmap is the qualified health plans. This lays out the process that we are going through to select the criteria for qualified health plans that will be offered through the exchange. We've just recently started, as of last week, a series of stakeholder meetings, both with consumer advocate groups, small business associations generally, and with the carriers themselves to develop what the Oregon-specific certification requirements will be for those health plans. Those meetings will take place over the rest of May and into June, and in July we'll present to our board of directors our proposal for the criteria for the qualified plans. We anticipate that we will release a request for applications in September of this year. Those applications, these would be from the carriers, would then be due at the end of December, and we will notify successful plans in probably the March, April, you know, second quarter of next year timeframe. That gives both them and us the time to finalize the products and get the plans loaded into the website prior to open enrollment in October of 2013. And concurrently, just for some context, the health authority and the insurance division are convening a work group around the essential health benefits package. And these are the benefits that all plans in the state will be required to offer, not just those sold through the exchange. And the governor has convened this work group under the auspices of both the Exchange Board of Directors and the Oregon Health Policy Board. So those two boards will be meeting jointly in August to look at the recommendations from the work group and then provide a recommendation to the governor that has to be submitted to the federal government by September. The community service, customer service and community partners line item of your roadmap covers the three major areas of our community partner program. That's the agents and the navigators. We have worked pretty hard so far on an agent management program that has been vetted very widely with stakeholders and presented to our board. For the navigators, that process is beginning. We're finalizing our staff work. We'll be presenting a very draft proposal to our board of directors at their board meeting next month in June. And then we will spend the next couple of months with a fairly extensive stakeholder process to get input on that draft plan before it's finalized. For the customer service center, we are envisioning a service center that is a no-wrong-door approach so that anybody in Oregon, any Oregonian, whether it turns out they're ultimately eligible for Medicaid or eligible for a tax credit or not eligible for any subsidy at all, who needs help, maybe being on, you know, they don't have access to the web or they go on the web and they just want to ask some questions before they select a plan or they would like a referral to an agent or to a community-based organization in their city or town that they can get some additional help with, that our service center will be able to assist them and that we don't have to give them another phone number to call to get help. We're in the process of looking at our options for that, both in terms of how we work with existing Medicaid service center programs and also whether or not that's something that we want to do in-house, have the staff ourselves, or we want to contract it out. So we're doing some cost-benefit analyses on those right now. No decisions have been made yet. Roger, did you want to add anything on that?
No,
Madam
go
Chair?
Ahead.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. You know, I appreciate the fact that this outreach plan is an integral part of the development of the exchange. I've been surprised and somewhat disappointed. We've done remarkably well getting more kids insured under Healthy Kids that we passed a few years ago, but I've been surprised at the number of kids that still aren't insured. And I think part of it has been, no matter how much we try to reach out, it's hard to figure out how to get to people where they really hear you. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what your experience would suggest about ways that we can avoid that problem here so that we really sometimes the people who are least likely to have insurance are the people who are least likely to have regular access to the internet, may not be mm-hmm. in areas that have public transportation, so signs on buses don't work. So mm-hmm. if you could just give us some sense sure. of that, if that's not too micro at this point.
No. Did you want to share that?
I think, Madam Chair, Senator Hayward, I think that's why it's really, we have a multi-pronged approach. I mean, you have, first of all, you have the customer service mm-hmm. center. And whether those are located in communities where people can walk in or whether that's by phone, that's part of the kind of the analysis we're doing. You have the navigators that we hope to certify, and those are primarily organizations that really be targeted to specific communities that are generally uninsured. Then you have the agent community, which, you know, does the traditional commercial insurance for small businesses. So I think the key is that you don't have just one approach. You just don't have one billboard. You're really looking at a variety of different approaches. So they're different depending on the community and the population that you're going after. It is early, but we're starting those discussions now with our communication contractors and trying to develop a series of proposals that are, you know, more inclusive than exclusive in terms of how we're trying to address it. Amy?
Yeah, Chair Monica Anderson, Senator Steiner, Hayward, that's actually a very nice segue into the next item. We have, as Rocky mentioned, we're also, in addition to, you know, the sort of smaller circle stakeholder outreach that we're doing now, which is with advocacy organizations and business associations and with the carriers, we are working on a comprehensive communications plan, and we have a communications consultant that's helping us with that. Part of what they're helping us do is look at sort of the different, you know, technical term market segments that we will want to try and reach, and what are the different strategies that we should consider employing to reach them. And, you know, some of them will be more traditional marketing strategies, and some will be very sort of grassroots community-based. And so we're finalizing that plan. I think we'll have a pretty good draft of it in a month or so, but we won't launch those efforts really wholeheartedly probably until, I would say, the second quarter of next year.
Thank you.
Can you close?
We can close. We'll close with just a quick update on the last piece, which is the IT. We've talked about it a little bit already. We have been, since we last talked to you in February, we have been undergoing internally a very intensive staff process to develop the business requirements. So as we mentioned, OHA has the contract with Oracle. They're actually building the system, but they need to hear from us what we need the system to do. So we have 11 requirements teams sorting out the scope and the business requirements for every segment of our work. That process is finishing up right now. We have been working very closely with OHA on that process. There are OHA staff and Oracle vendors that they've contracted with on all of these teams. We have OHA staff embedded in our office to make sure that we have close communication and that what we're telling them we need is actually going to make sense when they sit down and have to code it. So I'll probably just wrap it up there and maybe ask Rocky to say a couple words of closing. Are you good?
I'm good.
Okay. We'll stop for questions then.
All right. Well, we'll definitely want another update in September.
We will be here.
Good.
No further questions?
Yeah. Yes.
Senator Cruz.
Okay. So what you have on your sheet here is that we are here, award contract to web design firm, and it's that. Go down here. Okay.
Are you looking, Senator Cruz, Senator Monica Anderson, at the last line?
Yeah. And it's not checked off, but it sounded to me like...
Yes. So, if I may explain. We have contracted, OHA, I should say, has contracted with Oracle to develop the platform.
Okay.
We've currently put out an RFP that was a joint decision between the Exchange Corporation and OHA to hire what's called a user interface firm. They're going to design the piece that the consumer actually sees on the website, and they'll deliver that to Oracle to integrate.
You understood that completely.
Well, absolutely.
No, actually, I did, and she's right. They're right to do it this way.
Okay. Somebody's building the engine of the car.
I do actually understand that, yes.
Somebody's building the engine of the car, but we've hired somebody to design really whether it's leather seats, what the color of the car is, and they bring those together.
Okay. Thank you, Rocky, for putting it in.
And
car, I understand, okay. So.
Thank you very, very much. All right, with that, I'd like to call Dr. Bruce Goldberg and Mike Bonetto to talk us to us about updating what's happening with our community care organizations. Senate Bill 1580 from 2012.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Authority. We're here to give you a quick update as to where we are with coordinated care organizations and their implementation. As I think you are aware, when we left session at the end of February, we were charged with implementing this, and there it has been a tremendous amount of work and activity that has gone on, both in the community with a tremendous amount of work from stakeholders and organizations, as well as within the agency in moving this forward at what has been an extremely rapid pace. So let me turn things over to Mike, who will give a quick update as to progress around where we are in the implementation, and then I'll talk briefly about where we are with the other piece of this, which is working with the feds on the waiver as well as on the recent funding request that we had.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, Mike Bonetto with the Governor's Office. I believe everybody has a packet in front of them, and I'm just going to walk through some of the high points, as Bruce mentioned, around the progress on the CCO movement and the applications, and then Bruce will touch on the waiver. As you recall, March 1st, we submitted our waiver to CMS, and Bruce is going to give you an overview of that. Beginning of March, requests for applications to form CCOs were posted for public comment, and then we had those finalized. The temporary rules we had during the middle to end of March. We just finished Permanent Rules Advisory Committee. I think had their last meeting on Friday, and those rules will be filed the middle of June with an August 1st effective date. So regarding the certification process, I think I do want to make sure that I'm clear in even how we phrase a lot of this today, that we are in the middle, really, of this evaluation process. So I think, you know, Bruce and I, not really looking at taking the fifth today, but, you know, we are in the middle of a procurement process. So we do have to be careful in terms of really just how we answer, you know, some of those, any potential detailed questions. We did have 52 letters of intent, which I think certainly was a great response, as we had indicated earlier. We have set up, and I think we've talked to most of you on this, but set up four application waves. And I think that really has been beneficial to many communities who have kind of different levels of readiness. So we have an August 1, September 1, October 1, and November 1. 14 applicants for the first wave, and I think as you also have in this packet, but then there's also a handout that really goes through in detail, a little more detail, of those 14 applicants and their proposed service area by county. And then you have one other document that highlights the public presentation. So part of the application process for CCOs is that they do have a public meeting and they can actually demonstrate some public engagement. And you have those listed in front of you. So you have for every organization the date and time and the location of those. So if there are some meetings near you and you are interested, these are all open to the public. Next, I'll just quickly hit on timeline. I think many of you have seen this, but we did have technical applications that were due at the end of April. The financial application component was due last week, and then we are looking at certifying CCOs beginning of next week. As you see that the next column, you just see the dates there. Those really are reflective of the other waves. So waves 2, 3, and 4, those are the respective dates. We are looking at having those contracts signed with the new CCOs by the middle of June, because we do need to send those off to CMS. We need to give them a 45-day window so we can have those effective August 1. And I think with that, you know, my certain personal takeaway has been this really has been this unprecedented amount of collaboration. So, you know, Bruce, myself, Sean Colmer, we really have been traveling the state every week and meeting with stakeholders and their kind of their CCO development. And I think it really has been an amazing amount of dialogue and partnership that we just haven't seen before. So I think, you know, right now I feel like we are, you know, off to a good start. Out of those 14 applicants, even though we obviously we don't have certification yet, that is representing roughly 90% of the current OHP population. So I think, again, we have a good start. We'll see how this evaluation process goes, and we will certainly keep you in the loop and be in touch with you next week and let you know how that the certification process goes. And with that, I'll turn it over to Bruce.
Yes.
Mr. Bennett, just to clarify one thing, some of the, when you look at this sheet, the applicants and the areas that they're covering, there's certainly some overlap, which is good. But if it were to happen that, say, one of these weren't to be certified and there were people who were covered through that particular current MCO, for example, an MCO that was involved, is the plan to help them transition to an approved CCO for that area? Can you just walk us through that a little bit?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, I think certainly every applicant would be in a position to review the comments that they would receive during their evaluation process and make a determination of whether or not they would want to move to wave 2, 3, or 4. But I think with that, certainly, whatever technical assistance that the health authority could be providing would absolutely be available. I mean, the intent is to have as little disruption as possible to have that continuation of care, so we want to make sure that we can enhance that.
Let me just add on to that, if I might, Chair Mona Sanderson and Senator Steiner. The goal here has been continuity of care. And that is one of the reasons why we asked for the letters of intent, so that we could very specifically begin to plan out where and how people would be transitioned, understanding that if there were areas where there were a couple of different applicants, maybe at different times, we would want to look at transitioning at different times to assure that we maintained continuity of care as well as choice. So we'll be working on, one, maintaining continuity, and two, providing the appropriate kind of technical assistance to be certain that every applicant is given the opportunity to respond appropriately and if need be, meet the certification criteria.
Thank you.
And one follow-up, too. In talking with some Oregon Health Plan patients, one of the Oregon Health Plan patients talking to me has a very rare type chronic condition, and no doctors really wanted to deal with her. In a case like that, I mean, she may be assigned to a certain provider who probably or maybe doesn't have the background to deal with the issues that she is living with. What are the CCOs going to be having various flexibility to handle patients with significant or different kinds of chronic disease?
Okay. Chair Mona Sanderson, the legislative intent as well as the intent of the agency is to have, the vast majority and almost all of the Medicaid population in these coordinated care organizations. And the organizations themselves are coming forward with applications showing that they will be able to meet the needs of the population in their geographic area. Having said that, it's always been clear that there are the occasional exception where the needs of a particular Medicaid beneficiary may not, for whatever reason, be able to be met through a coordinated care organization. In that case, there is an exception process to assure that those on the Oregon Health Plan will be able to have their health care needs met.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you. When I'm looking at your applications and you have, I mean, all care has part of Curry County, which is totally understandable. And then Western Oregon Advanced Health also has part of Curry County, which is totally understandable. And part of Douglas, and actually all care will have part of Douglas, but Alan said they didn't want to just mention Glendale because that would be it. But then you get into Columbia Pacific, that has part, which is Clatsop, Columbia, Hood River, Tillamook, Wasco, and then parts of Douglas and parts of Coos. I mean, that seems somewhat, that's current status, I understand that, but that seems somewhat disconnected. I'm assuming there's going to be adjustments made, you know, that would confuse me to have a CCO that's way up here with pockets down here when there's already organizations there.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Senator Cruz.
Well, I mean.
No, I absolutely understand the point. The best that I can say is that, you know, we are really going to use the CCO criteria that's been outlined and really kind of overlay that with those applications and make those opinions.
Madam Chair, I mean, it's just, you know, a previous list to this of just the Medicaid population who's covering it, there's overlaps and I don't think that quite fits in the vision of spider webs going inside other organizations. So,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Bates.
I'm going to play off my good colleague here just for a second, and you can take the fifth right off the bat, okay? We realize people are lining up for this, and we're really happy they are. This is really important, and you know, sometimes you throw a party and nobody shows up, you never know what's going to happen. Obviously, it's a big party now, and that's the way it should be. But some of these areas that are outlined here, and we've been looking at them over the last 5 or 6 weeks, so you have very small populations. I'm a little concerned about them actually being viable. If you take Eastern Oregon and knock it off into four different of these organizations, there may be some real problems. So I'm hoping that you'll be able to, when you look at this and make your decisions about certifying CCOs, take into account the small populations, the geographical locations, and not just whether they qualify for a CCO under the law, because the intent was to get enough population together that we really could do something with it. Second point is, some of these organizations in the first wave are really making a huge effort. Some of these people in the first wave are making a huge effort to be successful. And they are actually risking some things here to do it. And they've done a lot of work, as you know, talking to counties, talking to mental health organizations and drug and alcohol organizations and physical and dental. And a lot of what they put together is new for them, and they consider it almost proprietary. And they don't mind it being shared at a later time, but they're a little nervous about it being shared before those first three or four waves go through. They feel like then sometimes they're going to be competing with other CCOs. They would like to have that held back. I know there's information, Freedom of Information Act going on here, but if we can hold off on that through the first three or four waves until this fall or the first year, I think it'd give them a lot of comfort as they go forward with what is really a terrific new experiment they're going through. And if you could comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Bates, members of the committee. Let me take the second one first,
yes,
which is the issue about balancing out proprietary information as well as public requests for information about what's happening in their communities. We're working through that, and what we're developing is a process whereby potential applicants will be able to redact what is proprietary information. And information which really isn't proprietary, but are things that members of the community, it would be appropriate to understand who the members of the board of directors were and things like that, which really aren't proprietary, would be available. So I think we're being able to strike the appropriate balance between maintaining the organizational integrity and balancing out the public's right to know. Your first question around size and criteria, et cetera, the short answer is we're clearly balancing out what are the criteria around the ability to be fiscally sound and maintain the appropriate kind of reserves and management structure to assure that these organizations are sustainable, along with the issues around representation of a particular community. And those are the things that we're evaluating, and I think several of the applications show some creativity around how they would balance those issues.
Senator Steiner, Hayward.
I'm going to give warning to the people who are going to be talking about Tri-County. I'm going to ask you the same question I'm about to ask these gentlemen. one of the issues that we face in Oregon is that the majority of subspecialty care is concentrated in the Portland metro area, and we know that all of the major hospital systems there serve as referral bases for sources for the entire state, and that's good. That being said, are you working with some of these smaller applicants, or are you going to be working with them and with the big Tri-County CCO to talk about how the arrangements are going to be made to address the needs of patients who really can't receive the kind of care that they need in their communities? Could you talk about that a little bit, please?
Sure. Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Steiner, members of the committee, each applicant has to be able to show that they have a panel of providers that's sufficient to care for the needs of their members. And we've been and have been very successful in the state in our current managed care organization structure, whereas those managed care organizations have had to show that they have contractual relationships and an ability to deliver what is the vast majority of subspecialty care, and that they have some mechanism outside of what is a contracted relationship to be able to do that. So that's built into the application, and part of the review is the ability to assure that members from around the state will have the full range of their care needs met.
Thank you.
Will you be looking at systems change? And I'm concerned that this is what feedback I'm getting, that particularly with the Tri-County, and again, Tri-County, you can respond to this when you come up, is more looking at the global budget and that maybe the hospitals are going to be preferred in delivering care where we have, say, I love citing the cataract surgery that can occur in an ambulatory surgical center for $2,500, yet if you have it in the hospital, it's $8,000, yet if you have a collaborative with the decision makers being the hospitals rather than the other deliverers of care, I mean, how are you going to take that into account, too? Because I am concerned that everyone's concerned about where the money is going to go, and it may be directed more toward maybe a more expensive option than, and so are you going to be able to flush that out?
Chair Mona Sanders, no, absolutely. And I think what we've really tried to do is align the certification and evaluation process really with the legislative intent. And if we really go back and look at what was outlined, there were some specifics around new payment methodologies and, you know, how are we going to look at integrating, you know, physical, mental, and dental health. I mean, all of that component, and how are we going to have community engagement, all of that is within their application. So, I mean, part of that is the thorough review of them having to really to demonstrate that they can meet that criteria. So it is much more than just having a global budget in place. You know, they have to start to outline, you know, how they're going to move into a new care model.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike, the particulars of the Tri-County area are challenging, right? And I think that's where the bulk of our Medicaid population, or at least over a third of it, will be. Looking at 1580, it seems clear that it certainly allows and arguably could encourage more than one CCO to be operating in the Tri-County area. If as that progresses, if it's one or two, or can you talk a little bit more about how you're going to ensure that the patients have provider choice? Because that's clearly spelled out in the document as well. And I'm trying to get my hands around that as this process moves forward. How will you ensure that a patient is able to stay with their current provider if they want one, or have the choice of going to who they want to go see?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I'll defer to Bruce on this, but my you know, opening comments really what Bruce had talked about earlier. I mean, continuity of care has really kind of been kind of the forefront principle that we've been looking at all along, and certainly, you know, with what was established in 1580 of, you know, allowing for more than one, I mean, that's been part of the process. And I think, you know, we have you know, certainly never said that there's only one, or, you know, we've been very open to that. So I think the certification process and the evaluation process is very much reflective in that. And I think, you know, to the much that we can ensure continuity of care and ensure choice, I mean, those are the kind of the key elements that we're going to be looking at.
And Chair Morton Sanderson, Senator Shields, members of the committee, just let me reiterate that member choice and continuity is what's going to drive this, continuity of care. And what we're doing is, since we don't know where, we're in the middle of the certification process, and we don't know where there will be one, two, three, four, or more, it's hard to talk explicitly about how that will happen. But needless to say, as it's becomes clear how many organizations there are that are certified or that will quickly become certified, as per Senator Steiner Hayward's question, the issue will be how we transition people to a CCO in a way that maintains their choice of what will ultimately be both provider, where they can get their care, as well as their choice of a CCO. And we'll be laying that out area by area as that moves forward.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah. Choice is an interesting thing. Back in the wonderful world of fee-for-service, I know there were some folks in Medicaid in Salem whose choice was a physician in Portland, and we would pay for the taxi to take them to Portland. And, you know, there's got to be some trade-offs here. I mean, you know, we're trying to get away from that whole fee-for-service with whatever we're going to pay for, but there's got to be some responsibility on both sides of this as far as choice. Choice has to be limited to a degree, I would think.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, indeed. The one issue is the choice between a couple of different plans in a geographic area. So that's, I think, a separate issue from what you had indicated, and what we had mentioned earlier is that individuals will be enrolled, if there's one CCO in an area, the intent is to have everybody in a CCO. There will be the occasional exception, but that will be made around the kinds of circumstances that warrant it, that aren't simply around convenience, for example.
Yes, Senator Bates.
Well, there's another piece of choice that I would like us not to lose sight of, too. That's choice for the state. In most of the state, I think you probably have geographically defined areas that are catchment areas and probably have one CCO there, maybe occasionally have two. In the Tri-County area, I think the state needs choice, not just the patients, but the state needs choice. And I'd be very disappointed if we didn't have at least two CCOs up there. And I'm using the word disappointed cautiously here. We really need, that's 40% of the Medicaid population, huge population in OEB and PEB. And I really, really encourage you to think about two CCOs in the Tri-County area. It's going to be really important to have that for our choice.
Go for three.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Bates, I think the answer to that is that the legislation and how we're rolling this out clearly calls for a certification process, not a competitive RFP. So by definition, the number of organizations that meet the criteria will be certified.
Thank you.
That's us taking the fifth.
Proceed.
Okay. So to move forward with the last piece of this and how we're working with the organization that actually is our majority partner in this, which is the federal government, I think, as all of you know, that the Medicaid program is a state-federal partnership, and the feds pay about 63% of the bill in our Medicaid program. As such, they get a fairly substantive say in how we run or don't run our program. That's done through a waiver process. We submitted what's known as an 1115 waiver on March 1. You all had copies of that. It's a 176-page document. And in essence, what it allows for are a couple of things in summary. It really lays out and allows for the provision of Medicaid services through a CCO. And probably the biggest thing that we're seeking to waive is the ability for local communities to be flexible with payments, how they pay for things, what they pay for, and the manner in which they pay for care, so long as they meet the quality outcomes. Our discussion with CMS has been really one around what are the things in the legislation that require their approval and what pieces don't, and we can just go ahead and implement. It's primarily around the federal, the financial flexibility. We've been having very good conversations with them. As I've indicated, dating back 6-8 months ago, we began to work with our federal partners. So the waiver request was nothing new to them. They'd seen all the ideas. We've had multiple work groups. And we're confident that we can work through towards an approval of that waiver by July 1. In addition to the, as part of that waiver request was a funding request. That was the request for some funding to help us move forward with this program. That funding was put through as part of a federal program, which is known as the Designated State Health Program. It's called DSHP, D-S-H-P. And what that does is, it's a program by which, upon federal approval, the federal government will provide Medicaid match, federal dollars, for programs that are related to the health care of the Medicaid population, but don't necessarily serve people who at that moment in time are enrolled in Medicaid. So there's got to be a nexus to caring for low-income populations. An example would be the dollars that go to counties for uncompensated mental health care. We pay state dollars to counties, no federal match, that go to the provision of indigent mental health care. At the same time, we know that from month to month, that population moves from being uninsured to being on Medicaid and likewise. What happens now under this program is that the feds will give us federal match for that program, which will allow us to free up some of the state funds that currently pay for that program, and those dollars can be moved then into the Medicaid program to pay for CCOs. So it's really matching currently unmatched state funds for health programs that support low-income uninsured individuals. We've come to an agreement. I think you've heard the governor was in Washington, D.C., and spent a lot of time with federal officials outlining to them both the vision of what we were trying to do here, what was captured in the legislation, as well as making a clear case for this funding request. In the end, we came to an agreement, and the agreement between the state and the feds was as follows, that we as a state agreed to move our Medicaid program into this coordinated care model, as outlined in the legislation, that we would lower trend in per capita Medicaid costs by 2 percentage points, and that we would improve the health care, the health of the Medicaid recipients receiving care in the Oregon Health Plan. So this wasn't just about managing finance. It was also about improving health. Along with that, CMS agreed to match sufficient funds to free up state funds to be used only within CCOs in the schedule that I've outlined. It's $230 million in state funds in year one, $230 million in state funds in year two, $108 million in year three, $68 million in year four, and $68 million in year five. Those are dollars that will get freed up that are currently providing services to uninsured individuals, which we will now be able to put into the Medicaid budget, into CCOs, and those dollars can then be matched. So that's how we get the dollars that we need. The federal investment is returned.
Oh, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me, Dr. Goldberg. We have an expectation, if the Affordable Care Act remains intact, of expanding the Medicaid population by 200,000 lives. How does that fit with the $68 million, and what kind of a hole is created in our budget by virtue of the expansion of that population.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Morse, the expansion of the Medicaid population through the Affordable Care Act that you're referring to will begin pending the Supreme Court decision January of 2014. For the first 2 years of that program, the cost of care for all of those new eligibles, the approximate 200,000, is borne by the federal government. It isn't, none of those costs are borne by the state. As a result, our ability to lower costs, per capita costs, by 2 percentage points during that time period is a tremendous benefit to the federal government. And indeed, that's one of the ways that we've been working through with them to show them that over the first 5 years of this program, our ability to lower that trend by 2 percentage points will return that federal investment in full within those 5 years. So these dollars don't create a budget hole for us. As we start to, as those dollars decline, so however does the cost trends on our side. So unlike some previous federal support like that provided through stimulus funds where we were given a bolus of money, that then went away, and then we were left with a budget hole. What we've contemplated and set up with the feds is a way in which those federal dollars go away, that we actually gain additional general fund dollars through the savings in lowering the trend by 2 percentage points. So this does not create a budget hole. In fact, what it does for us as a state is create a sustainable Medicaid program out into the future. And I think that was the vision behind these coordinated care organizations by the legislature, was the ability to more cost-effectively manage care, not by cutting rates or by cutting people or by cutting benefits, but by fundamentally changing how care is delivered, getting at what Senator Monis Anderson was talking about, was looking at the ability of these new organizations to change how care is delivered, focus on primary care and prevention, take care of problems before they incur high costs, and in that way, lower cost.
Thank you. As a follow-up, my understanding was that one of the complaints by the states in their action against the federal government was the imposition of a mandate to fund this expanded population. And you're saying that there is not a state match required?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Morris, during the first 2 years, it's 100% federally funded. In the years that follow, it ramps down to what is approximately a 90-10 federal match, which is, I think it's 2 percentage points or thereabout every year or two over about a 10-year period. So there certainly is some state funding that indeed goes into taking care of those newly eligibles, just not during those first couple of years. I'm sorry, I wasn't clear about that.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Just to be clear, and we did this on the phone, what we're talking about is flattening the curve 2%, not actually reducing costs. One of the things I would like to know, you've made some pretty bold statements as far as future savings. It'd be nice to know your front-end assumptions that allow you to get there, and even at that, even if you can do the 2%, you're still assuming a growing economy, or it doesn't work. I mean, if we stay flat, we're still going to be in the hole, and we haven't seen a whole lot of signs of economic recovery in this state yet. The other piece of this, outside of whatever happens in June, is we can assume at some point in time, although God knows when, the federal government may actually pass a budget. and that may change some things. It won't be, as long as we're doing continuing resolutions, it's same old, but at some point in time, they're getting nasty about it again back there now, and at some point, they may actually do a budget, probably won't be before the election, but they're going to have to. And I just want to make it clear what we're talking about. You know, I was an econ major. I know what you can do with assumptions. And so it'd be nice to know what your front-end assumptions were to reach those figures you reached. I will say that transformation should be able to create efficiencies and flatten the curve, but the real question becomes, does that curve flatten enough to make up for the sluggish economy we're currently in?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, so two different questions. One is the assumptions, and two is the revenue side, which I would just say parenthetically, I'm not so certain that the healthcare system has the ability to control the revenue side. What the healthcare delivery system can do a better job at is controlling the unit cost on the healthcare side. The assumptions, the assumptions around the 2% were based around what some analysis that was done and presented to the legislature during session from some outside experts that looked at the possibilities of what could be achieved over time as we better integrated physical and mental health, moved to primary care medical homes, changed how care was paid for, used different delivery models. The 2% is a much more conservative figure than the conservative estimate in that report. That report had a conservative estimate as well as a liberal estimate, not wanting to use political terms, but not thinking on my feet today. So let's just say that, and you can hear this coming from my mouth, Senator, this was a much more conservative estimate than the conservative estimate in the consultant's report. That's around which this is based. So, you know, obviously, we had a lot of discussion about that. And what the reality is in terms of our ability to do this, I think we're going to work closely with the CCOs. I think that by any definition, we know that there's an opportunity for much greater efficiency within our healthcare system. And I think that it's going to be incumbent upon us as a state, as well as the CCOs, to work as hard as we can to get that. Regarding the revenue piece, again, I think the goal here was to flatten the growth and cost curves and to get it to a place that it becomes sustainable and gets better pegged to other economic indicators, whether that be CPI, state revenue, et cetera. That's always been the goal. And in the short run, we may not get a revenue picture that increases to the level that's necessary, but certainly what we do know is that any flattening of that cost curve is going to help narrow that gap, and so it really is upon us to do that to the best extent possible.
No, Bruce, I wasn't blaming the revenue picture on you. So.
Senator Bates had a question too.
Not really so much a question, a comment, and see if you agree with this. And it goes right along with what you're talking about. My memory on these numbers are that the cost curve increased cost on an annual basis right now in our Medicaid program is about 6%. And correct me if I'm wrong, which is really below what it is in the rest of healthcare. That's because of the managed care organizations, both mental health, drug and alcohol, dental and physical health, doing a really pretty good job of holding us down. You're trying to move that to 4% over the next couple of years. I think it's very achievable, by the way, which lines up more closely with the revenue forecast and the revenue incomes we've had in the state over the last 10 years, admittedly the last 2 years being flat, which would not help us. Bottom line here is, if we don't do this, what do we do? And that's what other states are facing and not being able to move on it. They are frozen. We are the only state moving forward with a program that offers a hope of this. And I think the reason the feds are so interested in us is because they put in 63% of the money. They also get 63% of the savings. And they know that if they go with a program that says we're going to add, you know, another 20 or 30% of people to Medicaid, and the feds are going to pick up 100% of the first 2 years. The last time I checked, they have a little deficit problem at the federal level. They're going to have to do something about that cost curve across the United States, and that's why they're looking for us to do it. So all that said, Madam Chair, I would like to thank Dr. Goldberg and Mr. Bonetto and the governor for incredible, unbelievable work in the last 2 months. I've tried calling these people occasionally. They're getting off and on planes in Baltimore, getting off and on planes in Washington, D.C. They're back there almost every day for the last 6 weeks, talking at the highest levels of government and selling a program that, quite frankly, I think is breathtaking in its breadth, and something that can really turn the state around as far as these costs are concerned and giving better care. And these people should be thanked for the work they've done. It's just absolutely, to me, amazing you pulled this off. So thank you very much.
Thanks. Also thank the rest of the folks that are coming up next.
Absolutely.
Because they're the ones that are going to also have to do a lot of the heavy lifting.
Now they better make it work or we're going to be in trouble. Okay.
We're in big trouble. Any other questions or comments? All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you.
With that, we're going to start with the Dental Care Organization panel. Deborah Loy, Russ House, and Mike Shirt. Cliff, would you please come forward? They would like to present their how they feel. They don't want to be left out. Let's put it that way. And the CCO, and hopefully the CCO boards are going to listen to what these people have to say.
These are people complaining. They should complain.
Deborah, do you want to go first?
I would. Thank
okay.
you. Chair Senator Mona Sanderson and committee members, for the record, my name is Deborah Loy. I am the Executive Director of Government Programs of Capital Dental Care, a contracted dental care organization with the Oregon Health Plan. I'm extremely appreciative of this opportunity to share testimony on DCO experience to date and transformation, and specifically on Capital Dental Cares. Globally, DCOs have some shared experience following our excerpts from a recent letter sent to an emerging coordinated care organization and signed by all eight dental plans. It summarizes some key points that are shared by all the dental plans. House Bill 3650 and Senate Bill 1580 state a CCO must contract on or before July 1st with any DCO serving members in their service area. Legislative Council provided clarification in a Senate Health Care Committee meeting during the 2012 session that any means all. As a major component of the health care delivery system, along with physical, mental, alcohol, and drug, the DCOs believe we can contribute to patient-centered care and triple aim goals in the near term. DCOs serve 97% of the Oregon Health Plan population. Many of our members have long-standing patient relationships with primary care dentists who will have an opportunity to become a part of coordinated care and team-based care. Through early engagement and flexibility offered under global budgets, the DCOs have a pivotal opportunity to invest in additional prevention and create chronic disease management programs that include oral health and strive towards reductions in oral health disparities in these populations. By developing outreach partnerships between the DCOs and other emerging and other major components of the healthcare delivery system, oral health can be transitioned from a focus on procedures to health outcomes. This is exciting to the DCOs. During floor speeches introducing Senate Bill 1580 for a vote, Senator Bates, Representative Kotek, and Representative Freeman all included statements about dental. These legislators brought welcome affirmation that oral health should be viewed as a critical component of overall health. DCOs have already been creating unique outreach programs and opportunities for population-based care. We continue to develop these models of care tailored to the Medicaid population, as well as piloting alternate payment. And I normally don't read, but I don't want to miss anything from this, so please hopefully bear with me, as well as piloting alternate payment methodologies to control costs and produce better outcomes. We contract with hundreds of providers and cover close to 600,000 members, Oregon Health Plan members. As a participant in CCO governance, models of care, and clinical advisory groups, the DCOs are committed to being active partners in shaping the future for health care. The DCOs believe our insights and experience can position a successful integration of Oregon Health Plan dental and successful transformation. We believe it is possible to have better health, better care, and lower costs for Oregon Health Plan by including oral health. And as stated by a U.S. Surgeon General, one cannot have health without oral health. The DCOs are here to help. And I'd like to comment specifically on those statements that were included in that letter. One particular issue is not all emerging CCOs are necessarily interpreting any as all. There is some tendency to think once you engage with one dental plan, you're done. That doesn't require. So we, any of the ones that we're involved in, we have been leading them to the place of any means all. Many service areas have more than one DCO. It takes all of us to provide the care necessary to serve those particular communities. Not just one of us usually could do that. We already know amongst ourselves that we don't expect to have, like in the Tri-County area, 8 dental plans involved in governance, that we'll work that out so that we have the appropriate representation in agreement with the CCO governance structure that they're building. The statutes also state on or before. There's some tendency now to view that date as a we have plenty of time to wait to get to dental versus engaging with dental as early as possible. Even if the dental plans have expressed a willingness to engage early, that hasn't been necessarily reciprocated. They're also, because the statute lists for governance, it talks about risk-sharing bodies and major components of the healthcare delivery system, and then lists sort of a laundry list of a physician, a mental health provider. There's some tendency to interpret that as all-inclusive, and it's been very difficult for dental plans to be recognized to have any place in this emerging CCO. And also, it is not real clear how in some of it, what the legislative intent has not always been clear to those emerging entities as they build their structure. For the successful inclusion of DCOs, their providers, and transformation in these emerging CCOs, it would benefit from legislative intent being clarified, as well as support from the legislators, the governor's office, and Oregon Health Authority leadership. I'd like to speak specifically on Capital Dental Care's experience. CDC is the largest dental plan with about 195,000 members statewide in 18 counties. We provided letters of support to 5 of the 14 emerging CCOs in the first wave. Our organization is most actively involved with Willamette Valley Community Health, and I'm pleased to comment on our experience in that emerging CCO. The communities of Marion and Polk are truly creating a new entity. I mean, they are really rolling up their sleeves, and it isn't one organization versus the other. It's the emergence of organizations. Dental is engaged in governance. There has been a distinct benefit in that particular emerging CCO that either Representative Thompson and or his staff person has attended routinely every single one of their meetings. So having a legislator involved in that has been really pivotal to clarify legislative intent on the spot. They also contracted with a key judge from the local area, Judge Abernathy, to act as a facilitator, and that has been an important, I think, contribution to the group's efforts, too. Other emerging CCOs and that CDC is involved in are in various forms of development, including dental. Most who have no dental experience have been very open to looking to DCO partners to help with integration. One particular emerging CCO does have some internal dental capacity, which leaves questions on DCO integration, specifically how that will take place in a way that does not impede access across all dental plans and that is sensitive to continuity of care and builds upon the current system and embraces the many years the DCOs have had providing services to this Medicaid population in order to meet triple aim goals and transformation and evolution. CDC has a very small administrative staff, especially our executive staff. Currently, admin is 8%, 8 to 9% of our capitation rate. So for the dental plans, that leaves me $1.48 to provide administrative services. So the fact that we've only been involved in five is not because of lack of interest. It's really due to lack of resources to be in the many other different service areas.
Thank you very much.
Chair Morton Sanderson, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Mike Shercliffe of Danes Dental, a DCO, a dental care organization. Deborah said they have 195,000. We have 187,000, but nobody's counting. It's been a lively competition and collaboration over the years. But we're the second largest. We have contracts and enrolled members in 35 out of the 36 counties in Oregon, mainly rural. I want to thank you for the opportunity to discuss my impressions of the CCO transformation process. I provided written testimony. I'm not going to. You can read that when you have time. but what I really wanted to do is kind of give my impression of the process. I've been to more CCO organizational meetings and CCO committee meetings across the state than I care to even talk about. One thing Deborah mentioned that's really interesting is that the limited resources that the DCOs have, and we've already gone through the process over the last 10 years of having no increases. In fact, essentially when you factor in inflation of actually having our revenues decrease is that we've had to do a lot of things to put efficiencies into place. And so it makes it difficult to have the resources to get around to the state to be able to participate everywhere you're supposed to, so I'd have to second that. One thing I wanted to say is that it's been an interesting adventure to keep up with over 14 CC organizational groups across the state. You'll hear a lot of interesting testimony today, and I could leave you with one note. I'm quite concerned about the integrity of the dental delivery system at this time, especially in those regions my company serves that are rural and frontier. Dentistry has problems having the resources to compete in the CCO process against those with greater resources, such as hospital systems, counties, and their health departments, insurance companies, and the fully capitated health plans. I want to thank you for having the foresight to allow dental the option to participate over time so this could be worked out. I think that was, there's a lot of debate around that, but I think it's fortuitous that you folks had the foresight to do that because it's allowed those of where they're ready to get in, those where they're not, it's given time to sort that out. The complexity of the physical health and relationship, the hospitals, the county, their mental health authority, and the county health departments has been really difficult to be able to deal with. Senator Cruz asked me questions. Too bad he stepped out during the interim about how it's been going, particularly Douglas County, and he wanted to know. I have to say that if all counties were as fair as Douglas County, it would have been a very good process. We've been able to work with the physical health, the county, the mental health department, and all the folks there, as well as Willamette Dental, to work out situations where we could actually go forward in a fair and honest way that allows all the parties that are being transformed, physical health, oral health, mental health, to get to the table and have input and be able to discuss things. Not all counties have gone that way, like Deborah said, depending upon how they interpret the law. Some of the regions have, and the people's organizing there have used the strength of their strength of the resources they have, plus the talent that they have that come with those resources, to kind of guide the system sometimes, I think, against the intent of the law. So I think that's something that, as they have the evaluation process, that they really evaluate that, because it's sometimes, in my opinion, of course, construed the situation to where you really don't get a fair and honest conversation to really implement the intent of the law. And I hope that you folks, as you go on, will look at that and make sure that things are as fair as they can and transparent as they can be. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
This is why I wanted to have you talk to us, because the only way, I mean, the CCOs are their own entity, and we know what the intent of the law is, and not all of us can be at these meetings, and some are very closed meetings, and so it really will be up to you to let us know how you feel certain and name the CCOs, how they are interpreting the law.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was interested, Deborah, in your comments regarding Willamette Valley Community Health, and since Madam Chair brought it up, does Willamette Valley Community Health, are those meetings closed to the public, or are they open to the public?
They're not open to everybody, but there's a whole lot of people there. So if not engaging, because they are trying to work through some of the proprietary things like contracting and things that others referenced before, but there's a whole lot of folks at the table there. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Senator Bates.
Yeah, just a quick comment. We're hearing from Willamette next, so I should probably shouldn't hold off, but I have to go to a meeting pretty quick. The original bill excluded dental from forcing them into CCOs, and we understood the reasons for that. But I think some people took that as meaning they're going to be outside CCOs, and that was not the intent of the legislature. We really wanted you inside the CCOs, and I think hopefully that's becoming more clear to the CCOs as they form. The other issue here, too, we'll be discussing this in Ways and Means, I believe tomorrow or the next day, was that dental care organizations have probably been cut more than any other part of the health care plan. They really can't tolerate, I believe, more cuts or they'll collapse. And we don't want to lose that. They are part of the continuum of health care, keeping people out of hospitals and out of emergency rooms. Without that, we would have people in the hospitals. I've talked about some of the cases that we've looked at, $500,000 cases resulting from a lack of dental care. So we don't want that to continue. We want to continue your programs. So all that said, I think the overall driving issue here for us in looking at where that money is going to go is going to flow through CCOs. And basically, inside a CCO, if you formed a true CCO, you're probably not going to see cuts in this biennium and potentially not the next biennium. But that means all people inside the CCO have to be treated fairly, including dental, mental health, drug and alcohol, hospitals, and physicians. We want to be sure that as those CCOs form up and we see the flow of the money, that does happen. We don't want dental care organizations inside CCOs shortchanged. If you do, it affects the entire system. That's the goal of a coordinated care organization, is that we get global health care for these people.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I'm glad you brought that to the forefront, because that's already going on. That's already happening in certain regions where it's let's throw in competitive bids, have the DCOs not be transparent, and let's throw in competitive bids, and that's already going on. That's quite troubling. In fact, there are some regions where some have stayed out for that reason, because of the unpredictability of the funding. We know that 1804 is not enough, but we know what 1804 is, and we might not know what it's going to be inside of a CCO, and so it makes it pretty nerve-wracking when you're already on the edge already to be able to be hung out there, not especially when you don't get to the table and are not allowed to be in governance like the legislation we believe intends, and they say we're going to let you in later. And those kinds of things are very troubling when you don't know what your funding is, you don't get to the table to have part of the discussion. And so that's why we think it's fortuitous that you allowed the DCOs to kind of transform in. We're only 5-6% of the budget, of the total dollars. I think dentistry could save the 2% if we did it right off your trend cost, just doing some things different, as you and I both know. So. I think that I appreciate you pointing that out, and it's out in the public. We all know it's there. We're aware of it, because that's already starting to happen. I think I think Russ is going to speak to that some, too.
Yes, we need to move along, so let's have Willamette Dental talk.
Thank you. Russell House, General Counsel at Willamette Dental. I agree with the comments of my colleagues here today, and also wanted to point out that there is a lot of diversity in among the DCOs and among the CCOs. They're pursuing their game plans differently, and there's a lot of good innovative discussions going on around the state, some very positive things. But one thing I could look at now is we can't start performing until we have a contract, and I haven't seen a form of contract, and there's 50 days until August 1st. And, you know, the DCOs have been taking full service risk for 18 years. Arguably, there's no more responsible alternative payment methodology than that full risk shift that we've been taking and which the CCOs will now be taking. We want to try to protect that. Some of the things that the CCOs may not be ready for, some of the CCOs, receiving the encounter data for over 500,000 lives, all the data that must be rolled up to determine forward pricing, that needs to be aggregated. And we need to try to ensure that the accuracy of that forward rate-making process is maintained. Arguably, the state should oversee data aggregation and utilization analysis, ensuring that the dental plan design is the same across the state, and ensuring that the dental's global budget is adequately derived from the utilization data. And dental providers should compete on a level playing field. HB 3650 does not support creation of regional monopolies. It does support continuity of care, choice of provider, and the DCO system. And we want to prevent market abuses and unnecessary transformational chaos. We want to ensure that initial assignment of OHP members to their current DCO provider. Members will select better performing DCOs in their service area over time. Service innovators will rise to the top. The state should support healthy competition by ensuring fair, uniform contracting and rules. And, you know, DCOs can and will coordinate better with healthcare providers, especially for pregnant patients, children and those with chronic diseases. And we need to implement new approaches to intercept dental cases before they present at the emergency room. We've heard that loud and clear. But to support this, the state should ensure preservation of defined dental benefits, actuarially derived sustainable rates, and uniform contracts. We tell DMAP and CCOs, hold us accountable to meet the new standards envisioned by HB 3650. And Dr. Tempass is here on behalf of ODS, and I'd like to defer some time to him if we could.
Okay, we have about 2 minutes.
Thank you very much, Bill Tempass with ODS.
And I just could you spell your name for the record?
Capital T-E-N space capital P-A-S. I want to thank you for allowing us to be here today. We're a little unusual because we are both an MCO and a DCO. So we are working with all the groups to try to coordinate care. We have some of the same concerns. The systems have not been even put together yet to accept our encounter data or our claims from DCOs. Our concern is with enrollment. The MMIS was a debacle, and if we try to go even further there in individual DCOs, CCOs, we're really concerned that the issue here was to take 500,000 that are enrolled with us, 500,000 plus, and roll them into a system, and we believe that we've given them good care. And now what we're going to do is to roll them into a system, and we don't know the reimbursement levels, we don't know how we're going to share encounter data, we don't know any of that, and the governance has not been shared with us. We've asked to be on the governance areas in certain CCOs, and we've gotten, they've said, well, you can serve on a committee. So we're concerned that the DCOs have not been heard. We believe that we can care for people. We believe in transformation. As you notice on that list, ODS is applying for some of the CCOs as well as we want to participate as a DCO. We ask you to allow us to do it in an economical and efficient manner. The number one thing is not the system. It's the patients that need care. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This is extremely valuable, and I hope the CCO boards are listening to what has been shared this morning or this afternoon. All right, Jeff Hetherington, Family Care.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the president of Family Care Incorporated. I'd like to talk a little bit about our CCO formation process and a tad bit about our history. I wasn't given a time, but if you want to do that now, I'll try and stay within it.
5 to 10 minutes.
5 to 10. Okay, 12. It was a joke.
I'm being serious.
Yes. Family Care has been around in the Medicaid managed care area for 27 years. We started out as a physician care organization, transitioned into the Oregon Health Plan in 1995. We were a dental provider under the PCO model and into the Oregon Health Plan model at one point. And in 96, when the DCOs were carved out, we took on what we thought was an extension of the Oregon Health Plan. Turned out to be a major war in terms of integrating our mental health contract into the Oregon Health Plan. And since 96, we've been the only married plan in the system, integrating both physical and mental health into our service areas in the Tri-County area. We have not had mental health integration with our plan in the other service areas. Along the way, in the development of the integration of mental health, one of the things we learned was that putting those two areas together certainly required a lot more services than just an insurance company provided. And one of the things we developed about 6 years ago has been referred to as navigators. We call them our service coordinators. And our service coordinators provide an awful lot of coordination both with the physicians, putting them in touch with services that their offices are not necessarily familiar with, both in the mental health area, but also in community services that physicians' offices, frankly, don't have any contact with. And then on the other side, on the patient side, watching the patient's utilization of care to determine whether or not how they're using care brings to our attention an intervention on the part of the plan that would direct them into another area of care. And that simple examples would be extensive use of the emergency room and use of drugs, polypharmacy, provider access. Those kinds of things automatically bring to our attention things where we may direct them to a mental health provider, we may direct them to an A&D provider. Sometimes the emergency room use tells us that they don't have transportation, that they don't have adequate child care, some cases that they don't have adequate housing, and phone use. So our service coordination department actually handles a multitude of social services that are not necessarily part of our contract, but certainly are part of an integrated system that we have developed over the last 6 years. The other thing that I would mention, and it came up a little earlier, is that we do have an awful lot of experience dealing with the prioritized list. And one of the things that was mentioned was the ability to pay attention to what I would call evidence-based medicine. And the prioritized list is an excellent model for that. We have been working not only with that model, but also developing further into an area of looking at evidence-based treatments, particularly in terms of diagnoses, and just because they're better or they're clearer or they're more easy to access doesn't necessarily mean that they're the right use of testing, and certainly aren't the most efficient and cost-effective ways of testing. And we've seen a lot of creep in that area and have been directing a lot of our efforts to saying to our providers what's appropriate, not just, you know, what is the newest thing to be using, particularly in the area of testing and diagnostics. Family Care is a nonprofit corporation, and so in that regard, our governance model is pretty well set up the way that was established in the law. Currently, we have 6 community members and 4 physicians. We have invitations out to 4 other practitioners, 2 more community members, and a hospital member, which will be added. We have had a nominating process from the partners in the community, asking them for mental health workers to be nominated for our board, and also, as was mentioned by the previous speakers, from the dental organizations. We do intend to cover dental care in our plan beginning on August 1st. We've had a number of dental organizations who have attended all of our stakeholder meetings, and we have asked them to come up with a list of dentists that we can put onto our governing board. I would say that, you know, from our point of view, we feel like the system has been fairly intense, but from an organization point, and I think most of the MCOs who are trying to transition would say that we've got most of our systems in place, not all of them. The development of community advisory committees is going forward, I think, with all of us, that it's been fairly involving in terms of involving the counties, but the counties have been, quite frankly, fairly cooperative in terms of working with us, and I think that's going well, and the same with the medical community.
One question, and it may be too specific, yeah, but what about your relationship with the hospitals? Have you developed an idea of who you would be working with? Is that part of your application?
Yeah, we have contracts well with most of the hospitals. A couple of them we don't have contracts with in the Portland metropolitan area and also in our other service areas. So I would say that the relationships with all but one hospital, which I'd prefer not to talk about, are very very good. And we've not had really any pushback except for the one. So
we have to move on unless there are further questions. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
All right. With that, we'll have the Tri-County Collaborative, Janet Meyer, George Brown, George Brown, and Cindy Becker.
Cindy, do we have their testimony?
Whose testimony?
From the Tri-County.
Not yet. No.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the Senate Health Care Committee. For the record, I am Dr. George Brown, Chair of the Tri-County Collaborative Board of Directors. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. As you may recall from previous testimony before your committee, the Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative emerged from a group of private and public organizations addressing a single complicated question. Can we together improve the quality of care and the care experience of Oregon Health Plan members and do it for less money? For the last several months, the Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative's participating organizations, Adventist, Care Oregon, Central City Concern, Clackamas County, Kaiser Permanente, Legacy Health, Multnomah County, Oregon Health and Science University, Providence Health, Tualatin and Washington County have been exploring how to create an integrated regional system of care for the 216,000 Oregonians who receive services through the Oregon Health Plan in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. The Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative's approach to partnering with communities to improve and coordinate services has emerged from hundreds of hours of work with local community members, behavioral health providers, primary care providers, social service agencies, community-based organizations, consumer groups, business groups, dental providers, health advocates, health insurers, and the Oregon Health Authority. This broad outreach has been and will continue to be the hallmark of our work. The Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative's participating organizations have established a new nonprofit public benefit corporation, and we are pursuing a 501c3 status. We have launched a public process for soliciting applications to fill out our board of directors for this new organization. Board application information can be found on the collaborative's website at tricountycollaborative.org. It should be noted that we plan to broaden the scope of legislatively mandated positions on the board, and we are recruiting the following: a primary care physician, a specialist physician, a nurse or nurse practitioner in primary care, dentist, a mental health provider, a chemical dependency provider, and two community at-large members. We have hired an interim leadership team
for a total of how many?
20.
20.
We have hired an interim leadership team led by Janet Meyer to my right, our interim chief executive officer. Janet's team developed and submitted the Tri-County CCO certification application on April 30th and financial materials on the 14th of May. The interim leadership team is also building internal processes, executing agreements, and establishing relationships across the community that will be necessary to operate as a CCO by the 1st of August. In a moment, Jana will speak in more detail about her team's vision. There are many challenges facing us. However, the clear commitment to the vision that participating organizations and the broader community have demonstrated makes me very optimistic about our ability to achieve something bold, innovative, and successful. The members of the collaborative have all signed an agreement that contains a number of provisions, including financial commitment. One organization whose involvement we valued highly was unable to attest to all the provisions, specifically an agreement not to pursue a separate CCO in the Tri-County service area. Unfortunately, that meant that Family Care could not continue to be a member of the collaborative. We are saddened by this development, as we believe that collaboration and not competition is the solution to healthcare transformation. We remain ready and willing to have Family Care join us at the table again if they can make the same commitments that other member organizations have made. We are only at the beginning of our journey. We are committed to engendering a healthy, thriving, engaged population, to eliminating health disparities, and to bending the cost curve so that we may have the resources to cultivate healthy communities for generations to come. Again, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you all today, and I welcome any questions that you may have.
I think it's important for you to take to heart what the DCOs have said. I know you're going to add a dentist. It'd be nice if that dentist was part of a CCO, of a DCO. I don't know. I mean, I can't tell you what to do, but it is a way. We want to make sure that we do some systems changes and have the most cost-effective way of delivering services. So do you have any comment on what the DCOs had stated?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have full intentions of having dentists be part of our governing board. As you might imagine, trying to get 11 organizations that were formerly in hand-to-hand combat competition, if you will, formed into a single organization with a common purpose has been a Herculean task.
And for the metro area, I can relate to that.
Yes, when I began this process, I had a full head of hair, and it was all black. So,
But I think it's important that there are decisions being made on how the DCOs, how the Tri-County Collaborative is going to work. And probably, and I don't know, how you're going to pay and who you're going to pay, et cetera, when the providers aren't a part of your board yet, and I think that that concern has been relayed to me anyway.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can assure you that we have spent the majority of our time on developing a model of healthcare, submitting a CMMI grant, and putting a governance mechanism in place. We have made no decisions yet about mechanisms of payment or how we would regard the dental care organizations. But Janet can certainly give you more specifics on that. But our intent is that to have a true improvement in the health of the community, obviously you have to include a good comprehensive dental care. And we think the DCOs play a very important part in that process. But because we're so complex and so large, it has taken us time to mold these organizations, 11 of them, into a cohesive group with a common purpose.
What about entities like ambulatory surgical centers? I mean, they're, to me, market share, you know, I think the hospitals won't want to have market share, but have you looked at systems changes as to how you can really use services that are in the community that maybe can provide the service at a lower cost than the hospital can?
Well, absolutely. And I represent a health system, obviously a system of hospitals. But to be honest with you, our intent is to try and push care out of hospital, out into the community as far forward as we can, because that's really the true healthcare transformation. So having Oregon Health Plan members come to the emergency room unnecessarily, unnecessary admissions is not in the best interest of my system, nor is it in the best interest of the community. So looking at services that are ambulatory, as you suggest, is exactly our focus.
It's so good to hear you that and have it on the record.
Thank you. This may be better held until after Ms. Myers speaks, but I'll start now, and if you want to continue it later. As you may know, I've been a practicing physician in the Portland metro area for 21 years now. And frankly, if you had told me a year ago that we'd be here now, I would have asked you what you were smoking. So I want to congratulate all of you. It is indeed, it must have been a Herculean task, and I think it's remarkable that you've gotten this far so fast. That being said, I want to express some of the same concerns that Chair Monis Anderson did. I'm a primary care physician. I'm used to being at the bottom of the pile. And frankly, you need me and my colleagues at the top of the pile right now. And I really hope that we're going to hear very soon and quickly, and I'd like to hear some from you now, how those voices of how you're going to be structuring, restructuring care to get the primary care physicians, whom we know will improve outcomes and reduce costs, at the table. I value all the systems that have been in play and that have contributed an enormous amount of time and money and expertise, as all of you represent, to this process. But I got to tell you, I'm a little worried because historically there have been times when the hospital systems have sort of taken us for granted and not really listened to what we know is better for our patients. So I'm not trying to be whiny. I'm trying to be proactive in helping you succeed.
Madam Chair and Senator Steiner Haywood, I am guilty of being a specialist. I'm a gastroenterologist, so I understand what you're saying, but I can tell you that the model of care team is led by primary care physicians and advanced practitioners, looking at how they can best serve this population and also looking at how to use non-physician resources to get care out into the community, out of hospital. Now, that might seem like it's a conflict of interest because my other hat is as a health system CEO, but I fully am aware that our current system of providing care does not provide good health outcomes, but it certainly is very expensive. So we are committed to truly transforming this, and I share your notions that I, too, never thought we would be here. In fact, when we meet every Friday, I'm wondering, What will the next Friday bring? Because we continue to go forward committed to this goal. But I appreciate your question, and I would welcome to share these models of care with you.
I appreciate that. Maybe we can meet. Can I have one quick follow-up, Madam Chair? The only other question I have is, I have not, to be honest with you, gone online and looked at the application for the other board members. Could you clarify a little bit? We're going to need a primary care physician on that board. Could you clarify what your criteria are? There's some rumor floating around that you're only going to be looking at employed physicians, and I want to clarify what you – okay, good. I'm glad to see that face on Ms. Meyer. And I think what that people meant, what you mean, is that a practicing physician, because that was certainly legislative intent. You don't want somebody like me who's doing, who's an academic physician and doing a half day a week.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Well, you really don't. Actually, I don't. You know, I don't want you to want someone like me personally. I want somebody who's out in the trenches every single day. And I'd like a little clarity to make sure that if it does in fact turn out to be somebody who's employed by one of the health systems, that he or she is going to have it in writing that they're going to be allowed to speak as a physician and not as an employee of a major health system.
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Haywood, our intent is to have a practicing community physician. We think it would be a bit of a conflict of interest, really, just because of the transparency concerns and the fact that rumors and paranoia are running amok. So we are looking for a community, a practicing community physician, to be a member of this board.
Thank you.
Okay. Is anyone else going to speak?
Yeah.
You have about 3 or 4 minutes.
Oh.
Okay, so I'll talk really fast. Good afternoon, Senator and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cindy Becker. I'm the Director of Health, Housing, and Human Services for Clackamas County, and I'm Secretary of the Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative. And I just want to talk to you a little bit about outreach. We have held a variety of meetings, stakeholder meetings. Our goal there is really to not only provide information, but make a two-way conversations to hear what members are thinking, hear what people are thinking, whether they be stakeholders, whether they be the general public, whether they be consumers, hearing the questions. And I have to tell you that there's assumptions that a lot more decisions have been made than actually have been. As Dr. Brown said, we've been running to do various applications, get the governance group together. This has only been since last December that we've actually started meeting together. So we really are trying to hear what folks are saying and to take that into account as we move forward. We're also in the process, and in addition to soliciting members for the board, we also have recently, actually 2 days ago, sent out a wide, hopefully going all over the place, email to start to populate our community advisory council. And so we are looking for folks across the Tri-County area. Obviously, 51% would have to be consumers, but we're also looking for people who are providers and also community members. We would love to have some people who really are not part of the system per se that are also part of the community advisory council. The council will obviously follow what's in the state what's in statute. They will be involved in the quality. They will be involved in strategic planning and also overseeing the community health assessment process, which I'm not sure you're aware of, but over the past year, the four counties, including Clark County, the hospitals and the public health entities have gotten together to develop a single standardized community health assessment process that can be used across the region. Not only will that decrease or eliminate duplication, but it will give us the opportunity to start comparing results because we'll be collecting similar data and similar time frames. That will also be a tool for the Community Advisory Council. I'm not going to go through everything else you're going to do. I also just want to mention that a couple of things. We've held two public presentations in addition to the stakeholder meetings. We have our third public presentation in Clackamas County. The others have been in Washington and Multnomah County. It's really important for the collaborative to be seen as not Portland-centric. We really want to make sure that we are getting information out and soliciting information from across the Tri-County region, because we have a lot of rural areas in the Tri-County region as well. We really are looking and soliciting information from non-traditional partners, people in social services, people in housing, and across the spectrum, because we understand that health isn't just about the time you spend in your doctor's office. And it really is the social determinants of health and the other aspects we really want to bring in as valued and equal partners to the Tri-County Collaborative. Finally, the last piece that we're working very hard on is the whole information data exchange. As you know, it's a huge mountain to climb. Not only do we not have, not everybody has an electronic health record. Those that do don't always have the same version. In the physical health world and the behavioral health world, they have as many behavioral health providers as there are. They have different electronic health records. We don't have unlimited amount of money to spend on this, so we're trying to figure out ways to develop interoperable systems so that we can collect real-time data and share information on the same individuals that we're serving. So with that, I'll stop.
Thank you very much.
Wow. I'm not sure I can talk that fast, but I will try. I will.
It's at East Coast.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the Senate Healthcare Committee. For the record, I am Janet Meyer, interim CEO of the Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative. I'm going to put my testimony aside and try and respond to your interests. But let me start by saying that we find ourselves in the interim leadership team chanting the mantra, move fast and break things. You know, with the Facebook recent IPO, we heard that a lot, and it's a very alluring phrase. Boy, that sounds like fun. Unfortunately, when people rely on you for their health care delivery and their health care benefits, you kind of lose your license to break things. And that's really the conundrum we are at every day. That's what's in my inbox when I come in the morning. How do we balance too much too fast with not enough and not soon enough? And how do we create that dynamic tension for change while ensuring that we do not destabilize the care system that these people, our enrollees, our members, are counting on? We have providers who are counting on us to get paid, to be able to see members that are enrolled in health plans. We need to make sure that system is sustained while we're changing it. People say it's like, you know, repaving the Sunset Highway during rush hour. You know you got to get it done, but you feel like you're in a bit of a high-risk zone there. The systems that we are developing are much more PCP-driven than what we have in place. The care innovations that we're working on are designed to support the PCP-patient relationship through non-traditional health workers, through better transitions of care. Our model of care committee and really our finance models, our IT models are still in development. I often hear from members of the community that it sounds like we have all the answers. And I think, well, gosh, if we have all the answers, why am I working so many hours every day? It doesn't feel like we have the answers. We're all on this journey together at the collaborative. And I am confident that the DCO partners, the other managed care plans that operate in our area will continue this journey with us because it is going to be a long road. I'm confident we can keep moving forward with it. And I'm pleased to see all the people who want to work with us because we want to work with them.
Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Several, all of you, I think, have referred to the problem of interoperability of information systems. You know, by the end of this year, pretty much every major health system in the metro area, practically in the state, will be using Epic. And yet, when I have a patient who transfers from Providence to OHSU or Kaiser to OHSU, I can't dump their data directly from their Epic into my Epic. That's a problem. And I'd like to know whether Epic's actually doing some work with you to make this manageable, make the bridges work, and not charging you an arm and a leg. Because, frankly, Epic is making a boatload of money off of our state right now. And they ought to be falling all over themselves, to be blunt.
I will quote Dr. Brown here and say that if you've seen one Epic, you've seen one Epic.
That would be exactly correct.
Correct. You know, our IT strategy is much broader than Epic.
Understood.
I understand that that it's an Epic town. We hear that a lot. We have a lot of providers, a lot of community service providers, mental health providers, dental providers that aren't on Epic.
Just to clarify, I was only using that as an example.
Okay.
I understand that there's a lot more to it than that, but that's, you know, if we think about what can we be doing to lower costs, my not repeating a test if a patient comes from one hospital to another hospital is going to save us money.
Duplication of services.
Right. I mean, there are a whole bunch of reasons, but I'm just using it as an example about interoperability. That was all my intent.
I do think that the Chair Mona Sanderson and Senator Steiner-Hayward, I do think that the IT potential out of the collaborative and the data exchange potential out of the collaborative is one of the more exciting opportunities we have. We have a large work group, well attended. All the chief information officers for the various entities are participating because we all see this as this is where the money can be found, is in this data interchange.
May I have a quick follow-up? I know we're pressed for time.
Really quick, because we really are
okay.
behind schedule.
I'm glad to hear all that, but what I don't hear is whether you're getting cooperation from the information system providers.
Madam Chair and Senator Steiner Haywood, I think we have an excellent opportunity since most of the healthcare systems in the metropolitan area are migrating to Epic. There is a product called Care Everywhere that allows some information to be transferred. I received an invitation today to go back to the Epic CEO's conference. My suggestion to Judy Faulkner, the CEO of Epic, is that I bring the area CEOs with me so that we can express what it is we're trying to do and demonstrate a model for the rest of the nation. And by the way, the Intel Corporation is working with us pro bono to help with some of the other IT problems.
That's great to hear. Thank you, Dr. Brown.
All right.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You very much Good for luck. All your work and you're doing yeoman's work, let me tell you. All right. Erin Kelly Seal, Director of the Department of Human Services, is going to give us information on restructuring, efficiency efforts, status of long-term care services, and transition to community services.
In 10 minutes or less.
Yes.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal. I'm the Director of the Department of Human Services, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I think that Mickey Cerise was making sure that you have both electronically and in paper form, whatever's most convenient for you, a couple of pieces of paper that relate to what I'm going to try and convey today to you. I appreciate the chance to follow on the heels of the health transformation effort to ensure that you also are aware that your Department of Human Services is also in the midst of some significant reform and transformation of our own, relating to but not entirely the same as the work that's going on the health systems transformation side. If you recall, when you passed House Bill 2009, you created two separate organizations, the Health Authority and the Department of Human Services. And what I'm finding is sometimes people don't remember what remained in the Department of Human Services versus what went over to the Oregon Health Authority. And one of the things I like about that confusion is that it's critical to me, and I know to Dr. Goldberg, if he were here, he would echo this, that we do stay inextricably linked because the clients, we share services. In fact, we designed the transition to two organizations so that we would maintain our connectivity and save money through shared administrative functionality. So it's very important that we are thought of as one, but we also have separate and distinct missions and assignments with regard to certain populations that I want to make sure that you're aware of. I was confirmed by the Senate about a year ago since then, I think, been coming to grips with our current reality. Not that it wasn't ever present before that in my role as the Children, Adults, and Families Director, but I think when I talk with folks who've been in my organization for much longer than I've been interfacing with it for the last decade, what I hear repeatedly is, Erin, it's never been this hard for this long. Our organization has expanded and contracted and taken many different shapes and forms. It's also been through the cyclical ups and downs, just like Oregon's revenue picture has. But as the private sector is also grappling with the reality of the new normal and the new economy, so too must government and must our service delivery systems. And remember, we do deliver some direct service out of the department itself. We have about 7,500 staff, but we also partner with counties, with private nonprofit service providers throughout our delivery system in order to ensure continuity of care and quality of care for the individuals that we're charged to serve. So this isn't just about a state organization, the Department of Human Services, but it's really a shared relationship that we have on the ground with private nonprofit as well as county government and other governmental service entities. What is remaining in the department today, just to be sure we're all on that same page, and this is on this front and back two-pager that you have, are five major program areas. We are serving the aging and people with disabilities group. We have the child welfare program area. We have developmental disability programs. We have self-sufficiency programs, which is a significant group of programs designed around people who are experiencing poverty, families and individuals. And we also deliver vocational rehabilitation services, employment and vocational rehabilitation services for about people with disabilities. Since the split, we've become smaller as an organization, and we've flattened out our infrastructure and really focused on realigning the services that we have to accommodate the new normal. Our caseloads have gone up in the last several years. As you are no doubt aware, we've had about a 70% increase in our caseload in our SNAP program, which is our Supplemental Nutrition and Assistance Program. We've had an over 60% increase in our Temporary Assistance for Needy Family programs. Overall, the Oregon Health Plan, we do all the eligibility work for the health care services, or 80% of the eligibility work for the health care services you just spent time talking about for Medicaid health care, and that caseload has grown over 50%. So without question, looking across all of the service areas that we have, the demand is increasing and the resources that we have to serve individuals are declining. And we've got to reconcile that. We can't continue to depend on the old things that we used to resolve that conundrum. In other words, more staff, more resources for program. And so we have embarked on an agenda internally to really create our own capacity to modernize our delivery systems, to be more responsive to consumers, and really relook at who it is that we're serving today, what our charge is around those populations, what our mission and goal is as an organization created in statute, and ensure that we have a really aggressive agenda focused on really meeting the current needs of the of Oregonians and doing so in a reduced revenue environment. And that's what I meant when I started earlier to say that we've been transforming our business practice. What you have in front of you also is a one-pager that looks, it's a chart that looks like this. And I just want to spend a couple minutes kind of talking you through what this very kind of high-level chart is designed to convey. We have been one organization with multiple programs beneath it for quite some time, but what hasn't necessarily happened, and I think we have a huge opportunity to achieve right now, is the level of shared ownership, accountability, and management across programs. It's true, and seeing Ms. Becker here from Clackamas County, who was part of the DHS reorganization about a decade ago, that we have tried and learned from past experience around integration efforts, and I'm not really meaning that same thing. I think we've evolved in our understanding of what our clients need, and we've also, I think, gained in our understanding about our functions, what we have in common, and how to achieve some efficiencies of scale while still allowing people to specialize in the areas of program that they're most passionate about. So I'm not saying to my child welfare staff that they have to care about seniors, but I am saying please understand the way that Adult Protective Services works and be learning across these safety-serving programs across populations to really ensure that we're leveraging the time, talent, and effort that we have across those program areas. That's just one example. Human services as an industry overall for quite some time has been very regulatory and compliance oriented, and by that I mean really focusing more on outputs, how many people are we serving, how many people come in our door, and less on the results that we're getting for those people who happen to have an experience with us. And so we're moving away from that more regulatory compliance, output-focused orientation, and more toward a conversation about what results are we getting for those individuals that we're serving. Are they safe? Are they healthy? Same conversation the healthcare delivery system is having, only really focusing on a person with a developmental disability. Are they living in community in as integrated a setting as possible? Are they having an employment experience? Not just how many people are we housing in residential versus in their own home. So really trying to make that shift. We've also been very policy and program focused. This is largely because of the way that we're funded. The federal government really supports almost every program that we have. About 2/3, but it's probably a little bit less than that. But you know this from your budget conversations. You know that most of the money that we have currently leverages federal dollars. After in the budget decline, we have fewer and fewer general fund only programs, and almost everything we do is also driven by federal regulation, federal requirement. In some ways, that's gotten in the way of what we would like to call as a consumer-centric, consumer-driven focus. We focused so much on what it is that we're buying and what our program is that we're delivering, and less on what it is that people are coming to us and saying that they need. So we're also making that transition and really hopefully leveraging technology, which is the next bullet point here to do the math and magic around pinging the right funding streams and making sure that we're having access to real time as well as aggregate data that we need to make good management decisions, good service delivery decisions, but allowing for the conversation with the individual to be about the individual, not about the program and what it is we have to offer. We do, as you've been talking about this entire day, currently have multiple disconnected data eligibility and technology services, and we have plans in place. I was heartened to hear about the conversation and interest in the exchange. We are the eligibility portal for Medicaid, and we are working on modernizing not just that portal for Medicaid, but modernizing SNAP eligibility, modernizing TANF ERDC. And our modernization agenda is being driven by the consumer, by the service delivery model that we want to have, and using technology to get us to be able to deliver service differently for clients, hopefully creating some of that capacity that I mentioned so that we can spend less time on paper and more time with people. We are also, and you know this, we've been having a conversation about continuous improvement in our organization for quite some time, and we've been leveraging solutions that our staff on the front lines have been creating in incremental ways. One perfect example of this around our workload and staffing issues is that we currently are staffed through the budget process in self-sufficiency to be at about 67% of the staffing level we need to actually carry out the mandates and the time it takes to do the work. So we're 33% understaffed. Absent one of our own staff's continuous improvement ideas, our staffing level would have been 61%. We generated 6% of our own capacity with that process improvement. Now, can we close the entire 33% gap with process improvement? I don't think that's true, and neither did McKinsey & Company, who came in and did an analysis for us quite some time ago that you've heard about before. But I think we can close a significant percentage of the gap, and we've got to create some of that capacity for ourselves and continue that press on continuous improvement. You know, our organization is often very responsive. We're crisis-driven. We are really making a shift internally and with our planning process to look long-term and be more proactive, preventive, and more anticipatory of the issues that are facing our consumers and making sure that our plans anticipate those issues and are building toward the future, not just reacting in the present. And finally, you know, I have an executive team that really understands that the complex needs that our consumers have cannot be addressed just by our organization on its own. We've got to be partnering with community-based organizations, with other governmental and non-governmental organizations, the business community, the faith community, to help really drive community orientation around our families, kids, adults, people with disabilities that we're serving to ensure that hopefully, in many cases, our touch in a family or an individual's life will be very light and that we will be able to facilitate their connectivity in their communities and with their families in such a way that we will be able to minimally be involved, and maybe in some cases not at all, allowing people to be self-sufficient. That's not true for all the populations that we serve, but for some it is, and we want to be making sure that we're collaborative and operating in partnership with community. Almost every single one of these bullet points that goes through some of our high-level efforts probably could take up an entire hearing, and I know that your time today is really limited and we're already over it, but I do appreciate the chance to just paint in some broad brushstrokes what it is we're trying to be about. I'm happy to touch on a couple of the individual items that you put on down on the agenda, but I'm feeling like in the sake of time I should ask whether, Madam Chair, you'd like me to do that or you'd like me to come back another time and do that.
Probably you'll have to come back another time, but I do want to, I've been meeting families in my district. One family in particular comes to mind in my district who has an 18-month-old foster care child that they wanted to adopt, but you found another family living in Eastern Oregon where there are two siblings living there who are related to this child. And I think the only problem that, and they said that they would adopt that child, they wanted to adopt that child. And so DHS made the decision to have that child adopted by the family in Eastern Oregon. But I think what was tough on me was I see the mother coming home and the little toddler running and so excited to see mommy, and her mommy. And the problem I had with it is it's taking so long to get the paperwork done so that child could actually be put in with the family that you had made the decision to transfer her to. And again, if you're understaffed, but can you just touch on is there any way to speed up the process when you're dealing with putting a foster care child who's very, very young more quickly into the family that they're going to end up with?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that story touches on so much of the complexity and the hardship of the work that our folks are dealing with on a day-to-day basis across the state. And you bring up the workload issue, which I think as an organization we work really hard not to use as our first response to conversations like this, but it is without a doubt impacting our ability to process paperwork and to do the work quickly. And I just spent a bunch of time in Southern Oregon, four different counties, and I heard repeatedly from folks that in child welfare, where we also happen to be staffed at about 67% of the staff that we actually need to do the work, because that system is often responsible for life and death decisions, we get a phone call. You know, we're managing over 70,000 calls, reports of abuse and neglect annually in that system. We have, with the staff that we have, prioritized what we call the front end of the system. We've prioritized the work that we do to respond to reports of abuse and neglect to ensure that children are not getting harmed in families where we have a report about abuse and neglect. And that has compromised our ongoing work and our work around adoption and permanency for kids. And it's not something that our staff likes to have to say out loud. But they're just simply, you have to prioritize work when you don't have 100% of the staff that you need. And so unfortunately, we have seen things slowing down on the back end, which is around moving kids into permanency. But I also believe that our staff are doing everything that they possibly can to continue to work within what they've got for the best interest of kids. So are we in a tough spot in child welfare right now? We absolutely are. Is it impacting kids and families' lives? It is.
Thank you. Other further comments? Thank you very much, Aaron. Sorry that you had to rush, but we will want to have another update in the future.
Thank you for the opportunity. All right.
With that, I'd like to call Kathleen Brown, Dr. Brown, up, who wanted to talk about some time-based fee scheduling billing system. And if you can cut it to 10 to 15 minutes, that would be very nice.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And
should we move the computer?
Okay, good. Can we move it over? Okay. So I'm here today to talk about...
State your name for the record.
Okay. I'm Kathleen Brown. I'm from Coos Bay, Oregon. I think I'm going to move the computer over so I don't have to lean. And I'm here to talk today about a time-based fee schedule and out-of-network insurance coverage. I'm going to introduce myself very quickly. I'm from Virginia. I'm a Virginia transplant. I completed two residencies, dermatology, internal medicine. I used to practice both specialties, did well in my studies. Was on faculty of Johns Hopkins University Hospital in Dermatology and Internal Medicine, and achieved a number of honors. So we moved here in 1997, joined Bay Clinic in Coos Bay, where I practiced for 13 and a half years, and over a number of years became more and more mired in paperwork and became harder and harder to practice quality medicine, exhausted, overwhelmed. It was just difficult. And so as of last summer, I opened what I thought was my ideal practice, which I enjoy very much. And I have a solo practice, and I designed it from the bottom up to be affordable, to have transparent pricing, to have access to treat people from all walks of society. So... we honor a nostalgic method. This is an alternative model of care to some of the things that you're hearing. Some of these pictures bring back some memories for some of us. And I'm not... So some of the things that we've found out is that we're actually extremely affordable. We're more affordable than Blue Cross, than Medicare. We have pruned out a lot of the various technical issues here. A lot of the things that don't contribute to patient care. My philosophy is very simple, and I've always felt that I work for my patients, and I think most doctors feel that way, but most doctors recognize that there are many obstacles in the way of that. I feel that we have an obligation to resist those obstacles, surmount those obstacles. So what I did... this is, you know, the relationship as I see it in a conventional insurance-centered practice, insurance-based practice. Patients have contracts with their insurance companies. Doctors or medical groups have contracts with the insurance companies. And then probably the most important contract is the unwritten one, which is our obligation to work for the good of our patients, and that is rooted in the Hippocratic Oath. It's rooted in law and fiduciary relationship. So my new practice, I'm not contracted with insurance companies. I'm not contracted with government. So it's kind of an out-of-the-box option. We have some testimonials that people can look at later. They're very nice. People had things, patients had things that they wanted to say about how our practice functions. We're very patient-centered. Senator Bates, you're quoted here. Healthcare is rapidly becoming unaffordable, and I think we agree with that. So some examples from my practice. OCD is Oregon Coast Dermatology on the left, and whether I treat or don't treat a benign lesion, I think both of the doctors here recognize there's various rules about treating things and freezing things, that someone walks in my office, has a little thing, they want it frozen, they don't, it's benign, it's precancerous, it's $20. And you can see the various different payments amount from Medicare or Blue Cross, whether you're treated or not. And we're going to show you a couple more examples very quickly. I have a narrowband phototherapy unit, very, very nice unit for treating psoriasis, eczema, other itchy skin conditions. In order to make it available for my patients, the treatment is, for the first month, is $15 per treatment. Second month is actually $10. So not quite as cheap as a tanning bed, but better. Dermatologists are very reliant on their pathologist, and previously...
Now, just one question.
Yes.
So you, your payment's like $42, but then I'm not quite sure I understand Medicare and Blue Cross.
Well, I previously did not collect money from my patients. We would pass insurance information to the pathologist, and the fee would be determined by their payer. So now we have a pathologist that charges us a flat fee because we collect the fee, and they bill us at the end of the month, so it's a flat fee. Quite amazing. I bill based on time. Usually, this sort of a procedure, shave removal, is way less than, and here's an example of one of my very typical patients, very sun-damaged skin, complete skin exam, looking for skin cancers, freeze a whole pile of spots. The bill for Blue Cross seems to work out to about $388 for that 30 minutes, and my bill would be $120. This is an example of different...
Meaning you get $100? I'm not still not sure.
Okay, so I charge at the time up, so people pay me directly. They pay me $120. If I do it in less time, they pay me less.
Mm-hmm.
But if you use CPT billing and you use the 17004
okay,
for freezing... 15 or more lesions, and a 99214 for, yeah.
Thank you.
Yes. So another example from one of our, I don't know if you want to go back to that, because that's a pretty neat one. Yeah, this is a patient, example from a patient we had who came in, had a biopsy by me. It showed a skin cancer on the face. We were early on. She had insurance. We referred her so she could use her insurance. She ended up spending $4,000 because she went to a doctor who used the outpatient surgery center, and they have higher facility fees. My fee, she came back, she had a second one. I did it for her, including the pathology. It was $450. And previously, when I was in practice at Bay Clinic and didn't use outpatient surgery, it was probably somewhere around $985. So you can see the nice prices that we're getting. So you've seen the affordability. I think, click on that little Here's Senator Vape's quote again, and talks also about paperwork, which is a very, very big issue for me. So I have less time on paperwork now. I'm going to talk very quickly about some other results that we've noticed that people who pay at the time have asked those nice questions about, doctor, how much do I need this done? How much is this going to cost? Different patients, you know, patients who don't pay anything at time of service because they're double covered or they have Medicare Plus supplement, they're very quick to schedule for things that they don't really need. So we've noticed
that... I'm sorry, Dara, but you actually mean the opposite of what it says up there. You say patients who ordinarily pay nothing at the point of service are less likely to schedule appointments?
True. People who pay nothing at the time of service under insurance model care.
But that's opposite what you just said. You just said that patients who aren't paying, who are double covered, are more likely to schedule unnecessary appointments. I'm confused.
Oh, I'm sorry. In the previous model, they would be more likely to schedule. We observed that in my previous practice, that people come in and they don't really have anything going on, and they come back whether they need it or not. They just do.
No, understood. I'm not disagreeing.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I got confused because I was hearing two contradictory things.
I'm sorry. So access, we're not taking any new patients since about 2002 because I was socked in solid. And we take new patients and we can get people in. So that's nice. And we're busy. So what I'm doing is, again, kind of outside the box, and it works for a different niche of patients. So a lot of our preferred patients, not preferred to me, but they prefer our model or our patients with high deductible insurance because they know what things will cost, patients who are uninsured, people with urgent problems because they can get in. And then, as I think a lot of people are aware, it's very hard for Medicare patients to get a new doctor at this point because of the squeeze on the fee schedules, and Medicaid has always been a problem. In my specialty, there's very little that's covered under Medicaid, so I take those people and take care of things they want cared for that are not covered. So there's the not covered. Not covered is a nice niche. Transparency, people talk about transparency in healthcare, but you hardly ever see it, and we have it. Quality of care. My whole office is focused on the needs of the patient, and I don't have any staff devoted strictly to billing and paperwork. And I have not had a single person who hasn't paid their bill. I don't have any outstanding, not one single person in 10 months. So it's pretty cool. So insurance challenges. There I am, the fish jumping out of the fishbowl.
But that means you don't take Medicaid.
I do not participate with Medicaid, but again, because of the prioritized list, as of whatever year they cut off acne, psoriasis, eczema, those people still want to be treated. I do. They come in and they find it works. So insurance challenges, I have all these different models. We have a $10 day, which is my semi-charitable. Charitable. It's my cost one day a month for patients who've been mine long term, who I know personally they are struggling. They may have Medicare, and I'm not participating with Medicare. So we have that. And again, my model works great for people who are uninsured. It doesn't fix their insurance problem in terms of expensive things, but it fixes their dermatology affordability problem. So really our issue that we're here today for is to advocate for our traditional patients with the low deductible insurance, the so-called great insurance plans. Those people have the more expensive coverage, but they're a lot of times state workers, big employers, union workers, and they don't have a lot of spare cash, and they would like to get coverage to see me under their out-of-network coverage. Oh, yeah, some insurance companies cover this without any problem whatsoever. So they managed to do it. So we have some patients that we interviewed, which, again, in interest of time, we're not going to show you here, but they talk about it just makes sense to them. We're achieving better costs. Why shouldn't the insurance company just reimburse? Moving along pretty quickly. So the thing that I'm doing that's really radical is I'm not billing by CPT codes, which are not transparent. They're extremely complicated. They're not part of the practice of medicine, but they're entrenched in our medical care system. I think they cause a lot of gaming. We've all seen that. And the impact on the patient-physician visit, the E&M codes, anybody who bills E&M evaluation and management codes knows that you have to think about what's going into your visit, the billing, the tail wags, the dog. You have to, because there's so many rules and you have to meet those rules. So,
unfortunately, some insurance companies...
Here, take the mic and put it in.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. Some insurance companies
and introduce
are turning...
Introduce yourself.
Excuse me. I'm sorry, Madam Chairman and Committee. I'm Jack Brown. Unfortunately, some patients are experiencing a lot of difficulty getting even 60% or 40% of their... when they submit their claim to their insurance company, and they're continually turned down for, you haven't dotted this I, you haven't crossed this T, you haven't put in the CPT, you haven't put in a number. And basically, the patients are being used as pawns because the insurance companies, some insurance companies don't like this cash style practice. And so they're turning the patients down.
So, yes, that's true.
So this is actually not a new model.
Exactly.
One of my colleagues in family medicine, Dr. Brian Forrest, has been doing this in North Carolina for primary care for some
yes.
time, and in fact is spreading it across the country.
Yes.
And is now at the point where insurance companies are actually paying him to do some of this. And he actually has data that show that patients, Medicare patients, save on average about 7 to 10% per year by just getting care directly from him rather than paying their out-of-pocket, even if they don't submit for reimbursement. And I understand your concern, but I guess I'm curious what percentage of your patients are having the kinds of troubles you're describing. I mean, are we talking about big insurers, or are we talking about some of the smaller insurers who don't cover a substantial number of patients in Oregon?
Thank you, Senator Steiner Hayward. It's the bigger insurers. May I mention names?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, Regents, Blue Cross, and ODS are the main ones.
And their rationale for not doing it is what?
You need to do it our way.
Okay.
So we've kind of removed a lot of bureaucracy, which works for a lot of our patients. But so that costs time to do that, and it's really apples and oranges if we're doing time-based billing. So I can stick CPT codes on there, but I really don't want to because it's not attached to a fee, and I think it shouldn't be attached to the fee. So,
it's a longer conversation, and we can't really afford to have it in committee right now.
Yeah.
Right.
And this is just informational.
Yes.
Okay. Senator
yes.
Bates and I can talk about this
yeah.
offline a little
I'd
bit.
I'd like to hear more about it, but not in committee.
Yes.
It's too
right.
complex.
No, you're exactly right. It's not new. It's just a lot of people have a hard time wrapping their brain around it. But it's been done successfully elsewhere, and it fulfills a niche.
We need to move on,
okay.
So you have next steps.
Okay. So our solution, actually, we've had a lot of help from former Senator Ken Messerly and from former Insurance Commissioner Gary Weeks, and it looks like we may have a tentative solution with those two insurance companies to accept a narrative description. We would like to see that they do that, and also that the Oregon Medical Board is reviewing their language and replacing the requirement for procedure codes with acceptance of narrative description of services.
Okay.
So there we have it.
Great. Well, thank you. This is very, very interesting.
Thank you.
And I thank you for bringing this forward to the committee. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate your interest in it.
Hi. Thank you.
Yes,
there are people that want to think about that.
Form?
Pardon?
You have a copy of your billing form?
Yes. It's in the packet.
Okay.
Oh, it's in the packet? Okay.
All right. Well, with that, we need to move on. And Chris Altenhoffen and Gwen Dayton, will you come forward?
Oh, we track too.
So Pam, you're gonna get another copy of
that. Right, so that's what we can track what's going on. Yes, big picture.
Good afternoon. Thank you,
just for
Senator Nomona Sanderson and other members. for having me here today to hear me out on this issue. We're somewhat changing gears, I guess, here, but listening to all of the other providers speak, I sympathize with them.
You need to state your name.
I'm Chris Altenhoffen. I'm a diagnostic radiologist from the Portland area. I do work for Epic Imaging. Just to clarify, it's not the Epic EHR. It's something totally different. We're East Portland Imaging Center, Epic Imaging. I am medical director there, but I'm not necessarily speaking for Epic today. So real brief history about Epic. We have been sort of the granddaddy of outpatient imaging centers in the Portland area. We've been there for 50 years. Now we operate three centers in the Portland area. And we think that we provide a unique and a valuable service to the Portland area. We have been one of the leading, if not the leading, innovator in medical imaging, not just in the Portland area, but in the state and even probably in the region. First with multi-detector CT, high-field MRI, digital mammography, PET imaging, all of which are standard practice today. Most recently, we've added PEM imaging, coronary CT angiography, and virtual colonoscopy, the last two of which are not reimbursed, by the way. We employ 175 people at our three centers in the Portland area. We're entirely a homegrown operation. We are full service at all three of our centers. And we're not just focused on the highly reimbursed imaging modalities of MRI, CT, and PET. Our ownership is 100% in state. All our radiologists live and work in Oregon, as do most of our employees, with the exception of a few that live in Vancouver. We do all of our own billing and marketing in-house. And unlike some of our self-referring competitors, whose majority ownership is outside the state, and employ radiology groups from Boise and from Southern California. We've been able to do all of this and be innovators in the area while maintaining the lowest costs and the best customer service in town. And we feel, given a level playing field, we can provide the best and latest technology with the best patient service at the lowest cost. And I think our history is our proof of that. We do get paid at least 20% less than like services provided in the hospitals. And we can't charge for a lot of our supplies that we utilize, unlike a hospital can. That means there's a lot higher expense to send patients to the hospital. This includes the hospital's outpatient imaging centers that can charge up to 25% more for the same services based on the hospital fee schedule. And we also provide quite a bit of charitable work through our centers through a variety of organizations. I've been with Epic for over 12 years, and over that time we've seen some dramatic changes in the outpatient imaging market in the area. And we are finding it increasingly difficult to maintain our own position and edge in the marketplace as an innovator, and even simply to support our employees' salaries and benefits. And it's become increasingly difficult to maintain our equipment and upgrade it. And upgrades are important. They can provide significant benefit to the patient, such as dual-energy CT scanners that will dramatically lower patient radiation dose. Some of the headwinds that we are facing include radiology benefit managers, pre-authorizations, and high deductibles, just to get started. But other more commonly known issues, such as structural restrictions in the marketplace by the health plans, such as Providence Health Plan, dramatic cuts in reimbursement rates for imaging services, and now the CCO concept, which we've heard a lot about today. And I can certainly sympathize with Dr. Brown when he mentioned the hand-to-hand combat that goes on in the Portland area. And quite honestly, we feel right now that the CCO concept is being used against us to cut us out from participation in those patients' care. And right now, about 20 to 25% of our patients at our Gateway office are Medicare or Oregon Health Plan patients. We've had long-standing relationships with the Multnomah County clinics. We take good care of their patients, their doctors like us, as well as other organizations that we've heard from today. And one issue that I thought was interesting is that that Tri-County restricted participation to a single CCO. We would be happy to participate in more than one CCO. And then finally, to the topic at hand, it's self-referral. Again, sort of shifting gears here. I don't know if everybody's familiar with the concept of self-referral in medical imaging. It has been one of the major drivers of increasing utilization in the medical imaging market. And the situation, self-referral arises when you have a physician or a group purchase their own imaging equipment and then is able to order and send their own patients to that equipment or scanner, and then they collect the reimbursement for it. Essentially, it creates a conflict of interest for the physician or group where they have to balance their own income against proper patient care. That's different from what we do with our radiologist practice, our radiology-owned practices, and that we are restricted from self-referral. We can't send patients to our own scanners and get paid for it because we're not the treating physician. This has really become a factor as high-end imaging, such as CT, MRI, and PET, has gained traction and with the growth of those modalities. So what does it does? What kind of effect does it have? Again, it creates a conflict of interest for the referring physician, as well as having other important implications. Number one, it does lead to overutilization of these imaging modalities, in particular CT, MRI, and PET. I did bring some additional paperwork that I don't think was distributed. And there have been multiple studies that have looked at this issue and have found utilization increases anywhere from 500 up to an anecdotally noted 700% when the physician has a financial interest in the scanner. Clearly, utilization doesn't remain unchanged or go down. There was also an email that included a meta-analysis that shows that self-referral is costing Medicare billions of dollars a year. It's also a patient safety issue in that excess CT scans means excess and unnecessary radiation exposure to patients. Other important effect that it has is on the quality of the exams. When groups are not competing in the marketplace for referrals, they don't need to buy the best equipment that they can. They can buy substandard equipment and perform exams as they feel is necessary, collect the reimbursement for it, and it's the same reimbursement as higher-end equipment. For instance, we just upgraded our 3T magnet, but we still see in exams in the Portland area that are 0.2 Tesla magnets, and the differences in quality is dramatic. According to another MedPAC study that's listed on that paper, 78% of non-radiologist imaging providers had serious deficiencies in staff or equipment. Self-referral practices don't have the expertise to tailor exams and reduce radiation exposures to their patients. And again, reimbursements are the same regardless of the quality of exam. And I know that there is perhaps some concern about over-regulating the imaging market, but self-referral is really an anti-competitive factor in the market. It distorts the free market. It effectively creates carve-outs for these groups where they can self-refer at will, and they're not competing in the broader market. And if you restricted self-referral, it wouldn't necessarily restrict the free market. It wouldn't stop people from entering the imaging market themselves. They just couldn't self-referral to the centers that they own. So this has been a long-standing issue. It's been back in the early 90s, the Stark laws were passed to try to address self-referral and medical imaging. And that was before the explosive growth of CT, MRI, and PET-CT. The Stark laws only apply to federal payers, and it has a loophole in it known as the in-office ancillary exception that allows groups to purchase their own equipment and self-refer. It was at a time when it was really meant for X-ray and ultrasound studies and not the high-end CT, MRI, and PET that we're seeing today. So several states, because of this, have enacted their own self-referral laws on the books, and Oregon is in the minority for not having any laws to address self-referral. Subsequently, we have companies that come to Oregon, targeting Oregon, because of that, establishing imaging centers that cater to the high-end modalities and are based solely on the self-referral model. These companies, again, are majority-owned out of state. Revenue leaves the state, and their radiologists are also based out of state. So last year there was a bill submitted in the House, but it didn't make it through committee. I did forward a copy of that to you. It is based on Maryland's self-referral law, which is really considered the most comprehensive law to date. It does limit the regulation to CT, MRI, and PET-CT, the highly reimbursed exams, but it also applies to private payers. So that bill that I forwarded to you is an adaption of the Maryland's law. One other point I would like to make is that, again, the CCO issue has been a big issue for us. A lot of the discussion today has been based on the CCO model. We do feel a bit that it's been monopolized by the hospital systems in the Tri-County area, and that it is being used against us to sort of put the final nail in the coffin for our practice. And so we're hoping that we can have access to the CCOs. We'd like to participate. We're willing participants. We will participate in both if possible.
We need to.
Yep.
But I would like to say that I'm sorry that we didn't have you first with all the with some of the CCO people in here so they could hear your presentation, because a lot of this with our CCO model are going to be handled at the CCO level, and the information you've given to us is very enlightening. So.
It was probably a good bill. Frank Morris is one of the sponsors of it.
It works. Okay.
Well, and, you know, outside of the CCO model, it also would apply to, private payers, which I think is important, too. I mean, that's driving healthcare costs in the country, too. And, you know, people with insurance are seeing, you know, higher costs, higher deductibles, and so I think it does matter to make it apply to non-federal payers as well.
All right, yes, Dr. Bates.
Just a couple quick questions. So in your model, there must be a profit margin of some kind here. Where does that profit margin end up going?
Well, right now mostly it goes to pay taxes. So we have nine owners.
And who are the owners?
Radiologists and one business manager.
Okay.
And you might think that we would be making a lot of money off of our ownership.
We
get paid our salary as a radiologist. And then on top of that, we actually take distributions, and most of it goes to pay taxes. We're an S corporation, so all of our taxes get passed through to the owners and taxed at our personal income rates. And so there's actually not a lot left over after we pay, you know, we make employee retirement contributions, year-end bonuses.
Understand.
Well, the other point is people don't understand our costs. We have huge costs. The service contract on a single MRI is over $100,000 a year.
I understand. Okay. What I was trying to get to is what the model actually looked like, okay? Self-referral in radiology is not a huge problem, I don't think, for radiologists. It's when primary care, other people own the machines, that it's the problem. So I understand that, okay? Built into their salaries is some of their margin, and that's where they make it up. They have to, otherwise there'd be no reason to own these machines, take that kind of financial risk. The other issue here, too, is that across the state, as many other states, some practices invest millions of dollars to buy these machines, and to suddenly cut them off from using them would be a financial disaster for some of those people. In fact, in the Medicare field, a lot of primary care people in the Medicare field, especially internal medicine specialists, they were cut off from revenue from lab, X-ray, and sometimes a CT scanner. They stopped seeing Medicare patients. They couldn't make it on the low fees paid in this state, not all states, this state in Medicare. So there's a lot of issues here that have to be looked at very, very carefully before we start talking about this, and we need to look at all of them. The biggest issue for me, and the one I'm concerned about the most, the one you brought up about CCOs, we're very concerned about the governance of some CCOs being run essentially by hospitals. That's going to be a problem for us because we will not get where we want to get to if organizations like yours who can do it at a lower cost are cut out of the mix. I understand that, and I hear that very clearly from you.
Yeah, well, we have a pain management service, too, that, you know, our charges for that are significantly lower than the hospital.
I hear you.
Okay. All right. Senator Shields, and then Gwen.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. It does have interesting implications for what we've heard before on testimony about defensive medicine and costly tests that providers pursue. But my question piggybacks off Dr. Bates. Your biggest concern when it comes to anti-competitive behavior is the hospitals, correct? Not smaller providers, or who? Where's your focus lie?
Well, so for us, we've seen both the hospitals and other imaging groups that have been based on a self-referral model come into the marketplace. And so, I mean, we're concerned with both, actually. And and they have had a dramatic impact on our practice, quite honestly. Probably bigger than when we lost Providence Health Plan, which we lost 25% of our business overnight right there.
When they decided to keep it in-house?
When they cut us out of their health plan, dropped us from their health plan, yeah.
We need to move on. Gwen.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm general counsel for the Oregon Medical Association. And Senator Bates, you actually made what is, I think, our primary point is, this is a really important issue, and this is a good time to be considering it as all of us are trying to work towards more efficient health care, and there's an imperative to do that. And the OMA is supportive of that. I think our message is that this is a complicated issue, and it's one that if we're going to take on, we need to take on thoughtfully and deliberatively. First, Stark itself is complicated. In my work as an attorney, I go to seminars, and there are days spent on it, and it's a challenging federal law that is also constantly changing. I think we're in phase three right now. So if we want to mimic or mirror Stark in Oregon law, certainly that can be done, but we just have to be careful about it so we don't set up a compliance nightmare that there are differing applications of law that apply. So that, and I think the CCO, the construct, also should cause us to stop and say, okay, how is this going to work in a system that is, if we do this right, will rely on referrals amongst providers and teams of providers. And so we want to make sure that whatever we do in Oregon to reflect some of the concerns that you've heard today also is workable within the CCO construct. And I didn't hear any disagreement on that point from you as well. And the other thing, this is based on Maryland law, and one of the things we might want to do, and the OMA is very happy to do this if you'd like us to, is inquire as how did that work in Maryland? What did they learn? What's good? What's bad? Did it really reduce utilization? Did it reduce costs, do they think? If they had to do over, what would they do differently? We can start with questions like that so we can do the best possible job with this. I think the time is now to address these concerns, and the OMA is very glad to. We just have to make sure that we consider all the factors that are in play, and otherwise we'll end up with something that won't end up really being enforced very well. So that's our primary concern. I'm glad to answer any questions that you have.
If you could do that,
yeah, glad to.
I that would be very helpful.
And Senator Cruz, we've actually started that process, and we're glad to continue that.
Okay.
Wonderful.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
It's been a number of years ago. I think it was Duke University did a physician, variations in physician practices across the country. And I think it included Canada. I wonder if they included self-referrals in that study. Does anyone else remember that? I remember attending a conference in Portland where they presented the findings.
Gwen's going to find out for us.
I will find out for you, Senator Morris. I'm not sure. But I certainly see if I can find out.
Yeah. Senator Ray.
If you could get the information, it would be interesting to see also the amount of imaging done in Oregon compared to other states per population. We're a pretty low utilizing state, but we're also wide open on medical malpractice. I would guess that's driving a lot of the imaging that goes on in the state, not just...
But we're going to fix that, right?
That's the plan. Okay. That's probably driving this too. But what's hurt in your organization is self-referrals outside of your group, going to people who are referring to their own equipment.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it. And with that, I will call Randy Everett, getting us an update on direct entry midwives, body art practitioners, and implementation of polysomnography technologists. If you can do it in 8 minutes or less.
Okay, I read it right.
You got it. Senator Melissa Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Randy Everett. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Licensing Agency, and so I'll give you the 7 minute and 50 second version of this. I am here to give an update on direct entry midwifery, respiratory therapist, polysomnographic technologists, and body art practitioners.
We don't want any more pictures, by the way.
No. Senator Cruz, we've had enough of that, so we won't do that for you.
The dermatologist here can fix this for us.
That's right. I'm going to start off first with direct entry midwifery, just to let you know that currently we've got 75 licensed direct entry midwives here in Oregon, with another 60 to 75 that are operating as midwives but are unlicensed. Currently, there's about 24% of the licensing base under investigation at any given time, and that normally runs around 2 to 3% for any of our other professions out there. During the last legislative session, the fees were set at about $1,800 per year for a direct entry midwife based on litigation, based on the number of complaints. This high percentage of our licensing base under investigation is very expensive. And that fee was legislatively reduced to $1,200. The ending result that I can tell you today is that the Board of Direct Entry Midwifery just went into the red this week. We anticipate that at the end of the 2013 biennium that they'll be about $40,000 in the red. And so we're going to be coming back to you somewhere down the road here and talking about that particular issue with you. Right now, the board and this licensing base is living off of the fees collected from the other 11 boards and commissions within OHLA. As you know, our agency provides regulatory activities for all of our 11 boards and commissions. We issue licenses, we conduct examinations, respond to consumer complaints, and we inspect their businesses. On a side note for this, and then I'll turn it over to Sammy Patnode for the rest of the presentation for this, the agency had just been notified 2 weeks ago of a $50.5 million lawsuit filed against the board and the midwives based on conduct of licensed and unlicensed midwives up in another part of the state. So we're prepared to start fighting that particular battle again. Mm-hmm. So with that piece of good news, I'm going to turn this over to Sammy Patnode, who is our policy analyst that can bring you up to date.
What would have prevented that lawsuit?
Well, we don't know all the details yet, but it is possible that if the rules were followed directly, or difficult to tell at this stage. I think we know what the issues are on the surface, but the investigation is ongoing right now, so we're still trying to figure it out.
Really.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, we went through this last session. I looked at a whole bunch of cases. I looked at what their privileges were. They've granted themselves privileges in delivery that only high-risk physicians would do in a hospital setting, and they've okayed that at home deliveries. VBACs, breach deliveries are okayed for them to do under their board, and as a result, they're going to have bad outcomes. One in four is under VBACs at home.
At home?
At home.
That's insane.
Saying that's the way it is. I think you've got a situation here that we have competent midwives in the state who are primarily nurse practitioners, well-trained, and I'm not even at the point of being prejudiced anymore because I don't do OB. This is a dangerous practice, and it's time for the state to wake up and admit that it's a dangerous practice and not get these people bamboozled into thinking they're going to have a home delivery that's going to go fine. We have hospitals set up for this. We've got people set up to handle these complex cases. And unfortunately, in OB, you never know until the last minute when you're going to have a horrible outcome. And when you're sitting in somebody's home with that, you're setting yourself up for disaster. That's the way it is in Africa. That's the way it is in some third world country. It doesn't have to be that way in Oregon. Let's leave it there. When you got 1 in 4 people under investigation, if that doesn't wake us up, what will?
It's a failed business model.
Let's see. I guess you can say it's a failed business model. People are dying, babies are dying, and you know, when something goes wrong, those poor babies end up in our hospitals on life support and other issues if they make it through it. It's horrendous what some of the cases we heard about. And we should probably bring some of those women back in here and have them talk to you about what they went through. And things can go wrong in a hospital. Okay? But what's going on with direct entry midwifery is really, I think, almost a crime.
Chair Melissa Anderson and members of the committee, I'm Sammy Patnode, policy analyst for the Health Licensing Agency. I will be very brief. Just give you a summary of what the agency has been doing for the Board of Body Art Practitioners and the Respiratory Therapy and Polysomnographic Technologist Licensing Board. So to start with body art, as you know, 2011 brought the legislature had us combine tattooing, electrology, and body piercing regulations and included scarification and dermal implanting. With that legislation, it also required that we consult the Oregon Medical Board regarding dermal implanting and genital piercings. It also allowed us to
careful
ask...
here. Too far already.
Sorry. I won't give the dinner. Big ones, I promise.
Don't say it.
We also were allowed to ask to consult them on other specific piercings, so we did, regarding cheek, nape, and uvula as well. Based on that information we received back from the Oregon Medical Board and with subject matter experts, the agency prohibited dermal implanting, scarification, and certain piercings such as uvula and subclavicles. What we also did is, based on what they told us, the Oregon Medical Board, is that the procedures we asked about were considered surgical, but with proper informed consent and education and training, then we would be able to allow piercers to do that if they have those things. So what the agency did is set up a standard body piercing license and then 3 specialty levels, specialty level 1 genital, no details, specialty level 2 genital, and specialty cheek piercing. And you can see here that we have listed out the hours and procedures required. The agency went to extensive outreach and training to the facilities and the practitioners. We had each inspector go out to every facility, letting them know what we were doing, and then we held a large presentation telling them what was going to be required in the coming months. I'm happy to answer any questions regarding that.
Yes, Senator Moore.
I'm not sure I want to get into this again.
You got us into
this person. Something that bothered me last session, or the last regular session, but what certified medical school is going to train people in these procedures?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, the plan as of right now is that we would work with urologists, and we have a gynecologist on the board, to create a training program that would show them how to, we have theory, I believe it's 60 hours for specialty level 1 and a certain number of procedures that they would use to learn how to do these specialty procedures.
I don't want to ask any more.
I'm wondering if we've gone the wrong direction here, because obviously the kids that are wanting to do this themselves have serious mental problems.
Hey, you're talking about my constituents.
Careful, that's recorded.
Thank you very much, respiratory therapist.
Yes, so... Senator Moses Anderson, members of the committee, again, 2011, Senate Bill 723 passed and moved the polysomnography technologist requiring licensure as of January 1 into the new respiratory therapist and polysomnographic technologist licensing board. Quite a mouthful. We have went through extensive rulemaking with them over the past year. We met with individuals from both professions and developed a rulemaking process to license respiratory or polysomnographic technologists or sleep technicians, whatever you want to call them. We are currently in the development of going through the rule, using Rule Oregon with a reasonable opportunity to access this profession, because there's concern that they can't get the education. So we've worked with at least two rural, either opposite ends of Oregon, on what would work for both of their constituents and their people in their area. And I think we've come to a good conclusion on what that would look like. We do go through the public comment process September or July 1 through July 28th, so we'll get feedback on what that looks like. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. As of today, 5 polysomnographic technologists have been licensed in Oregon.
Great. All right.
Just a quick question, this last one. This is legitimate. But thanks for waking us up. I appreciate this, Madam Chair. It was very effective. One of the issues was in rural Oregon of getting, we have people out there who have actually been doing it. We wanted to grandfather them in because you couldn't send people back and forth to do this all the time. I haven't heard much on it since we left sessions, which indicates to me you probably resolved this issue.
Senator Bates, I do believe we have resolved it. The only sticking point, I think, at this point is what some may consider telemedicine or training via real-time monitoring. The board is currently, under proposed rules, said no. I know there are some rural areas that are currently doing that as far watching a supervisor watching a trainee under real-time monitoring. So that is where I think we're going to have the sticking point during public comment. So we'll wait and see.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. My expectation is that you could do this through telemedicine. You should be able to do this through telemedicine. This is not, you know, there's no catheters involved, there's no needles involved. They should be able to do that that way. I would think you can get there.
Well, thank you very, very much. Dr. Smith, can you give a 2-minute report on student placement and clinical training?
Yeah, follow that one.
You beat that one?
Senator Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Janine Smith, the Administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research, and in 2 minutes or less, I wanted to draw your attention to some written testimony that I won't go and read, but it describes a response to your inquiry about Senate Bill 879, which was about how to streamline the requirements for students in clinical sciences that in order to go from one facility to the next so that, you know, Providence had one set of, and Legacy had another, and so we've through the Workforce Committee of the Policy Board, in partnership with the Workforce Investment Board, we've had 3 large stakeholder groups meet, and including all of both the academic universities, community colleges, the hospital systems, a wide variety of disciplines, and other interested parties, and we've come around about 5 or 6 things that they think they can probably have some standards around, and they're just going to continue to meet in June, and I'll have some final recommendations for the policy board at the end of June, and we'll make sure that those get back to you. But they need to also figure out how is it going to work. You know, is there a passport, or how does this, if a student gets their immunizations and their background check done, how do we make sure it transfers when the student goes to different places? So they need to sort out the final details on that.
And if I could, Dr. Smith, you've done this narrow. I mean, we're talking medicine now, but once you've been through the process at the state level, it should go for everywhere. And so if we can get it worked out here, then we can probably expand it as well.
Correct. The idea was to try to get some standardization, Senator Cruz.
Great.
So we can report back in the fall with the final findings.
And let us know you fixed it.
Thank you, Dr. Ms. Smith, so much for coming. And colleagues, it's 1 minute after, not bad for the amount that we had, the agenda that we had today. So thank you very much. And I guess we will reconvene in September. With that,
that seems weird.
We're not in recess.